I'd like to welcome you all tonight, and this is the House of Prayer call, and it's the 21st day of April 2022, so they say, and I'm sorry to say that our regularly scheduled speaker tonight was in the ER today with a mini heart attack or something of that nature. I don't know the diagnosis, but they said he had a small heart attack, and so we relieved him of the speaking tonight on the Private Membership Association, and he will be back on the 12th of May. That's Dave Edwards. He boasts about 37 years of experience doing private membership associations and faith-based organizations, and we're very excited about him sharing with us. And he's left me a whole bunch of resources, and so what I'm going to do is when I put this recording up on the House of Prayer webpage, where we lodge for the past year and a half, maybe so. We put all our calls up there, and we usually put documents up there. I know Ed, he's going to speak later on in the call tonight, and he shared some documents I'm sure he wants to have available at your fingertips. And if John has anything that he wants me to share, I put it up there. So usually what happens is if you went to myhouseshallbecalled.com, and hit the call recordings tab, you can find the...
You're mumbled.
Somebody needs to mute out over there while I'm talking, if you don't mind. Star 6 until you're ready to talk. Anyway, you go to My House Shall Be Called and hit the call recording tab, and you can record. You can play the recording right there on the webpage, or you can download the call as well as all of the documents that are shared with that specific call. And I'm pretty faithful about that. I know I've missed a few over the few years, but most everything is out there. When I miss something, callers are usually really good to email me and get on my case and say, hey, where's that document? So with that being said, I'm going to be sharing some private membership association information with you, along with a few documents that Ed has shared with us that go along with his subject matter tonight. And like I said, perhaps John might have something he would want me to share. And if he does, I'll make a list of that as well. So I just want to let you know that our next call, I'm going to restate it, is the 12th of May. It will not be in 2 weeks. It will be in 3 weeks. The reason why is I am going to be down in Florida, the area known as Florida, Lord willing, and I'm supposed to be sharing a little private share on the 6th and 7th of May in Florida. And if you're out that way and you are interested in getting together with other like-minded people and exploring some of the things that I've learned, whether or not that interests you at all, I do have things I've learned, and I've got some things to share. And it'll be my opportunity to speak up and visit with you. You are welcome to participate. You should be getting an email that has all of the information about how to contact those that are putting the small private share on. And so look for that in your email. It usually comes from Constant Contact, and it's a notification which has the date, the time. It's in Orlando, Florida, on the 6th and the 7th of May. That's a Friday and a Saturday. So this House of Prayer call is a ecclesiastical call where we are hiding in the shadow of our Heavenly Father's wings as ambassadors and ministers of His good news and His word. So with that being said, I want to inform you of the mission statement of our House of Prayer calls, which you'll hear every time we come on here. And we surround ourselves with Isaiah 58:6 and meditate thereupon as a mission statement and a goal to shoot for, which is this. This is the chosen fast, to loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burden, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke. That is a tall order, but we are attempting to rise to the occasion. Every day that we seek to get the boot off of God's people's neck and to, as Moses said to Pharaoh, let my people go. So with that being said, tonight our first speaker is someone that we are very well acquainted for. So thankful to have met John. He has shared so much life and inspiration into our calls. And tonight, I believe he's going to share with us some information that would be very foundational. This has been in other calls as well, but there are new people on here tonight that I know will appreciate hearing this particular topic of John's, how to acquire or attempt to acquire a bank account in the private
and perhaps even without a Social Security number, and the reasons why that could be available, along and some other peripheral issues that surround that. John, are you raring to go? Can everybody hear me fine? And do I have a listening audience?
I'm here.
Beautiful. All right, I'm going to give the floor to you, John. I think I took care of all the preliminaries. Welcome to the House of Prayer Call, and the floor is all yours. I hope that people will just save their questions until the end of John's conversation. Do not interrupt him when he's speaking, and please mute out by hitting *6 so I don't have to mute you here. Once again, hit *6. You can mute out, and *6 will bring you back in. Save your questions until myself and John has entirely explored the topic of the night, and then we'll open the floor for questions. And then, excitingly enough, Ed is on the call tonight, and he's got some special fellows that he's brought to the call with some testimonials, and he has some things to share as well. So we should have a very good night tonight. Sit back, get you a cup of tea, and let's get this party rolling. Go ahead, John.
Okay. Thank you very much. So I've, as Eddie said there, I've had this on a couple of times, but for new people, this is something that you can think about and decide whether or not you want to utilize it. But I can tell you my story and how it worked. A few years ago, I guess it's been a few years ago now, we had a note on a house. And the people that held the note sold the note. The people that bought the note, the bank sent me a letter and asked for my TIN number. So being that I'm pretty well acquainted with what all that is, I dove off into the Internal Revenue Code, and I wrote them a letter concerning their request. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to read this letter. Y'all get your pen and paper, because I'm going to cite some regulations and statutes that you're probably going to want to read, verify what I'm telling you. So anyway, I'll read this little letter to you and discuss it, and then we'll move on to the next square. So this letter went to the PNC Bank in Dayton, Ohio. And I said, "Dear Sir, Madam, we have received your letter requesting a TIN number, or if an individual, a Social Security number. Your letter cites 26 U.S.C. 3406 as requiring you to make this request. This letter indicates that it is used for several different situations that might require the production of some type of identifying number. The IRS is famous for using what is termed in the legal industry as word art to make people see a term and presume it would apply to them. A TIN number is defined at 26 CFR 301.6109-1 as, number three, an IRS individual taxpayer identification number. Definition: the term IRS individual taxpayer identification number, or TIN, means a taxpayer identifying number issued to an alien individual by the Internal Revenue Service upon application for use in connection with filing requirements under this title. The term IRS individual taxpayer identification number does not refer to a Social Security number or an account number for use employment for wages. For purposes of this section, the term alien individual means an individual who is not a citizen or national of the United States. Neither Lynette or I are alien to the United States of America. I was born in Texas and she was born in California, so obviously we would not have a TIN number. Neither Lynette or I are employers, so there's no reason for either of us to have any kind of EIN number. So that only leaves the Social Security number.
Hey, John.
Yeah.
I'm sorry for interrupting you. I know that you're reading in your letter right now, but I just don't want to miss it. Did I press the record button when we came on here?
I think so.
Did anybody hear?
No, actually, you started to, but then you shut it off. So you might want to check that.
Let me make sure of that, John.
It has started.
All right, John, just go ahead and start from the beginning of that letter again, because I just unrecorded and re-recorded. I apologize for that, folks. I just did not want to miss this House of Prayer call.
I will split it up on the call and we'll have my goofy little thing there. If you wouldn't mind starting at the beginning of that letter, John, just because of my ignorance, I really apologize.
Okay, no problem. So once again, take two for the recording. So we have received your letter requesting a TIN number, or if an individual, a Social Security number. Your letter cites 26 U.S.C. 3406 as requiring you to make this request. This letter indicates that it is used for several different situations that might require the production of some kind of identifying number. The IRS is famous for using what is termed in the legal industry as word art to make people see a term and presume it would apply to them. A TIN number is defined at 26 CFR 301.6109-1 as the term individual, the term IRS individual taxpayer identification number means a taxpayer identifying number issued to an alien individual by the Internal Revenue Service upon application for use in connection with the filing requirements under this title. The term IRS individual taxpayer identification number does not refer to a Social Security number or an account number for use in employment for wages. For purposes of this section, the term alien individual means an individual who is not a citizen or national of the United States. Neither Lynette or I are alien to the United States of America. I was born in Texas and she was born in California, so obviously we would not have a TIN number. Neither Lynette or I are employers, so there's no reason for either of us to have any kind of EIN number. So that only leaves the Social Security number. The W-9 form you sent is very confusing when you understand what all the terms of art mean. For example, Part 1 clearly asks for a TIN number in its heading, but then wants you to fill in a Social Security number. However, the certification section wants a sworn under penalty of perjury statement that you are signing as a U.S. person. To the unsuspecting person, that all seems well and good until you look up the definition of a U.S. person. You will find that definition at 26 U.S.C. 7701, parentheses 30. However, the definition of U.S. person leads you to such poor statute construction that the definitions of United States and state appear incomplete and vague. So the upshot is a person would be swearing to something that could not be positively determined in law. The instructions for the W-9 are much more simple to understand. They tell you which boxes to check under which circumstances. So all you have to do is figure out what you are and check the box. So you find the kind of entity that you are and be governed by those instructions. Since neither Lynette or I are corporations, partnerships, trusts, estates, sole proprietorships, or any single membership LLC, there is only one choice left, and that is the designation of individual. A search of the Code of Federal Regulations offers the unrestricted definition of individual at 26 CFR 1.1441-1 C3, individual. As the first definition is an alien individual. The term alien individual means an individual who is not a citizen or a national of the United States. Non-resident alien individual. The term non-resident alien individual means persons described in Section 7701B1B, alien individuals who are treated as non-resident alien individuals pursuant to 301.7701B-7 of this chapter for purposes of computing their U.S. tax liability, or an alien individual who is a resident of Puerto Rico, Guam, the Commonwealth, the Northern Mariana Islands, the U.S. Virgin Islands, or American Samoa as determined in 301.7701B1-BD of this chapter. An alien individual who has made an election under 6013G or H to be treated as a resident of the United States is nevertheless treated as a non-resident alien individual for purposes of withholding under Chapter 3 of the Code and the regulations thereunder. So there's a definition of individual. So as you can see, the term individual used so frequently in the tax code has two meanings, and both of them are some form of alien. So according to the law as it's written by the Secretary of the Treasury, neither Lynette or I actually have a place to properly complete the W-9 without agreeing to certain facts that are just not true. However, all is not lost. 26 U.S.C. 3406 provides a provision to provide a certification that backup withholding has not been requested by the IRS. So under 26 U.S.C. 3406 A1D, we will provide you a sworn statement that we have not received notification of any underreporting. Please find and close our statements under penalty of perjury that we have not been informed of any underreporting, nor has any backup withholding been requested to our knowledge. And then there's a signature. So we provided the two the statements that the law requires. And a little bit of time passed, and we got a letter back from the our friendly bank, and they said that they would thank you very much and that they would update our records. So we didn't provide a Social Security number for a house note. And that letter was what did it. Now, when you go back and analyze that letter, it covers all the points. And what they do is they'll ask a question, but you, when they refer to the statute, that statute's going to apply to about 16 different things. So you have to know who you are, what your relationship is, and all that stuff to be able to properly answer within the law. And one of the things that I brought up in there that if you're not listening close, you have to be able to determine every answer within the law. If they write some kind of BS statute that is not clear or it's vague or you can't understand it and it just doesn't make any sense, then you don't have to answer for the simple reason that you have to be able to understand what you're answering within the law. So if you can't find it in the law, then you don't have to answer it because you would be admitting under penalty of perjury that to facts that may or may not be true. You don't know if you can't understand. Somebody asks you, and Ed's going to cover this, somebody asks you if you're a U.S. citizen, well, what definition of U.S. citizen are you talking about? You know, do you know what it takes to be a U.S. citizen? All that kind of stuff we're going to go into a little bit later. So when somebody asks you to make a determination about yourself, the question is, well, what's the definition of that that term that you're talking about? Well, if they can't tell you what the definition is, you can't tell them the answer. So anyway, that's what my little letter says, and I want to call your attention to that definition of individual. And that definition of individual, they refer back to the first section of Title 26, 1.1. And in that definition, that's where it says every individual or every married individual shall pay. That's the one right there that says that the individuals will pay. Now, after you know what the definition of individual is, then you'll realize immediately that you shouldn't be paying individual income tax, unless, of course, you're a member of you're a citizen of some of those places they mentioned, and you know, you're non-resident of the United States. They lay out exactly who is liable for the individual income tax in that definition of individual. So anyway, that's my stick. I yield.
Well, John, thank you. Before we open up for questions on that, that was beautifully read. I was going to ask you, because I do know that there are people that are on this call that have made mention to me that they were pursuing about how to survive in the private without providing a Social Security number to a bank who, under their Know Your Customer, FinCEN, and Patriot Act lawyer-run program, seems to not want you to do business with them unless you demonstrate the federal person and give them complete disclosure of that private agreement or private relationship with the Social Security Administration before you can bank. Do you, perhaps I'm putting you on the spot here, but do you have any type of formulated idea of how a party could go about establishing this account with a bank, for example, using this technology?
Well, years ago, and it was before 7 and home security away with everybody. I had a bank account with no Social Security number. And basically what I told them when I went in there to open the account was, I said, well, we got to have your Social Security number. And I said, well, I said, this is a non-interest-bearing account, so there will be no need to report to the Internal Revenue Service. Oh, okay. So we went right on about our business. I had an account for years with no Social Security number. So,
well,
but,
and,
you know,
and that was your – go ahead.
Things have changed since that since Homeland Security went in there, and I don't know, you know, the thing about a bank is it's an organization of the federal government, and there is a congressional report out there somewhere that tells. There's like three or four reasons that you have to give your Social Security number. And I think one of them is a commercial driver's license. And then one of them is if your kids get like free lunches at school and for tax purposes. And I think there might be one more, but I can't remember what it is. And
federal benefits.
Yeah, federal benefits. There you go. And outside of that, I don't think you have to give it. Now, unless they've gone in and changed the law, I think the congressional report would do it. But here's the problem with dealing with somebody that's, you know, they're going to say, the bank's going to say they're private, which they're not. They're controlled by the government. But they're going to say that, you know, you have to have one. Now, here's the deal. What if you never had one? There's people out there that have never had a Social Security number. So if you go in there and say, hey, my daddy never got me one. I never got one. So I don't have a Social Security number. Then see what they say.
Like the Amish.
You know, they said, you know, my religion beliefs prevented me from getting one, and my daddy didn't get me one. So I don't know what to tell you. And see what they say.
Well, I've done that before, John, because for these people, I've got plenty of friends of mine that are separate and have separated their children along with birth certificates and SS numbers. They, for their own spiritual beliefs, and I comprehend where they're coming from, decided they want to be completely separate from anything that is in the name of government, and a statesman is not something they're interested in being. And I know plenty of those people at this moment in time in my life, and good people, and some of them have never had Social Security numbers, and the banks to date, I've been exploring this along with a couple of other people. They use what's called the FinCEN, Know Your Customer Laws, and they forbid any kind of access to their services. Of course, they claim to be, like you said, private, and they have a right to do this because they go have their back office lawyers tell them this, that, or the other, and you get denied. So what I'm sitting here doing, just kind of brainstorming with you on this call, kind of off the cuff, so please forgive me for that, kind of thinking what you would do if you were one of us in that situation. I mean, are we talking about the need for a lawsuit? Are we talking about something you think we can handle administratively with some letters back and forth? What's your thoughts, John?
Well, my first question, if they said, well, we have to go by this Know Your Customer Law, and I'd say, well, what does it take for you to know me? You know, only the IRS gets to know me well enough to have a Social Security number, and I don't know them. So what does it take for you? I'd ask them. I said, what does it take for you to know me? You know me as a customer, okay? You know my address. You know my wife's name. you know where I work, or if I, unless he works for himself. So what else does it take to know me? You want to know me. You don't know my. You don't want to know my relationship with the government. And that's what they're asking for. They're asking for a relationship between you and the government. That's not a relationship between you as a customer and them. So I would try to kill him with logic.
One of the things that they do, John, is they continually bring up the Patriot Act, the Patriot Act, the Patriot Act. They rely upon that very heavily. And, of course, it uses the vague and arbitrary and capricious term U.S. person. Comments?
Well, you know, it's just like the U.S. person that they define. The question is, what is a U.S. person? And I imagine the Patriot Act has a definition, or they might refer to the definition in the Internal Revenue Code. Well, if they do that, they're screwed, because we know what that definition is.
You know, I'm grossly unprepared to read you some of my response letters. They're in my office at point B, and I'm over here at point A. And granted, it's only 10 minutes away, but I can't monitor and call and go get the information. But I will tell you that I've had plenty of communications with this, trying to bust open a doorway there for a whole group of people that have been prejudiced because they're not able to operate and trade their wares and what have you, and been limited in their abilities. So prejudiced by way of these definitions. So I was just trying to formulate in our conversation tonight something to help those that wish to remain private. Is there something evil that comes to your mind about not wanting to give a Social Security number, John? How does that hit you? If somebody says, I don't wish to disclose my Social Security number, does that make you an evil man?
No, what it makes you is, it makes you smart enough to know that you don't want everybody to know your business. If they've got your Social Security number, then and they can tie any of your activities to some reason that they might conjure up to seize your funds, that's all they have to have, your Social Security number and a 50-cent letter, and they can take everything you got.
And I've seen that happen before as well.
Yeah. So,
if it's in a bank.
So that's what it takes. Now, I'm just going to do a little bit of off-the-cuff thinking. So if we have a group of people and they're in the and they're in a close proximity to each other, then if they wanted to, they could probably bank through an intermediary, where the intermediary provides whatever kind of numbers and all that kind of stuff that they want, and then they're banking within his room. I knew of a guy in California that would take Federal Reserve notes and convert it to gold, and then when you wanted to pay a bill, he would convert the gold back to Federal Reserve notes and cut a check on your directions. So that was one thing that happened several years ago. So in fact, Joan knew the guy personally.
Yes.
Dr. Priestley.
Yes, so, Joan Priestley, that was on our call here a while back.
Yeah.
So, John, so barring finding an intermediary, which is a great idea, if a fellow wants to continue plowing through this, do you see that there's any hope of winning, say, a declaratory judgment complaint for against a bank? And the second question, that's a two-pronged question, this congressional report you're referring to, do you have any other information to as far as what report that was, so we can go look that up, or is it just something you remember in the back of your mind somewhere?
That's one of the back of the mind things there that, but it, I'm sure it was before 9/11, and you know they changed the law. But before I'd stick my neck out and answer any questions on that, I'd have to read the statutes that surround that Know Your Customer Act and all that kind of crap that they're depending on. Yeah, well, I bet you $50 to a donut hole that none of those statutes have any regulations. And you know what that means.
Well, go ahead. The statute without the regulations is void, but go ahead and fill in the gaps.
Well, if they have a statute and there's no regulations to it, it's not generally applicable. And generally applicable means it's applicable to everybody in all the states. So if you go and you find a statute and there's no regulatory authority for it, under the Administrative Procedures Act, it's Title 5, Section 552 or right along in there somewhere, if it doesn't have any regulations, it can't affect you.
Let me find that right quick for you, and I'll read it to you. It's something that everybody needs to know about. I think it's 552. Let's see if that's it. Okay. The rules, I think that's it. Okay. All right. So, it says right here that each agency shall make available to the public information as follows. Each agency shall separately state and currently publish in the Federal Register for the guidance of the public descriptions of its central and field organization and established places at which the employees from whom and the methods whereby the public may obtain information, make submittals or requests or obtain decisions. Let's go down here. C, rules of procedure, descriptions of forms available or the places of forms may be obtained and instructions as to the scope and contents of all papers. Okay, D, substantive rules of general applicability adopted as authorized by law and statements of general policy or interpretations of general applicability formulated and adopted by the agency and each amendment, revision, or repeal of the foregoing. So if they have a rule that has general applicability, then it has to be published in the Federal Register. That is Title 5, Section 552. Let me see, there is one more index. There's one that says you can't be affected.
Are you talking about the Privacy Act, John?
No, let's see. It's not the Privacy Act. It's the okay, I don't think it's this one. I think it's 553. Definitions. Open meetings. Okay, hold on. Anyway, there's one. I know where it is somewhere else. Hang on a second. It is. Every agency has to print it usually. So in Title 26, it's 26 CFR 601.702. Okay. Now this is also, it's under Freedom of Information Act 5 USC 552 B and C. Okay. So this is what
is reflected there. So, you know, it tells that they have to have rules of procedure, descriptions, substantive rules, all that. So it's just what I read to you. And this comes in here. Let's see. Effect of failure to publish. So this particular one is at 26 CFR 601.702A2II. And you'll find this over in Title V also. But this is the effect when they fail to publish something in the Federal Register. It says, except to the extent that a person has actual and timely notice of the terms of any matter referred to in paragraph A1, which is everything, of this section, which is required to be published in the Federal Register, such person is not required in any manner to resort to or be adversely affected by such matter if it is not so published or is not incorporated by reference therein pursuant to paragraph A2I of this section. Thus, for example, any such matter that imposes an obligation and which is not so published or incorporated by reference shall not adversely affect or change a person's rights. Now, that's what the Secretary of the Treasury published for the regulations to be in compliance with the Title V, Section 552.
So are you saying then that the party, the lawyer, the law firm, or whoever's representing the bank there would have to cough up where in the Federal Register this general rule that they're trying to impose upon you as a member of the general population, it would be required to be in the Federal Register for them to be applying this general rule to you? Otherwise, there is no rule at all? Is that what you're saying?
You got it, Toyota.
Well, I'm just making it clear for the listening audience.
If they can't produce a regulation that restricts your rights to bank, or, you know, if that gives them the right to stop you from banking based on what they're claiming, they could just say, "Oh yeah, we don't have room for any more customers," and then there's not anything you could do about it. But if they want to use that excuse and you say, "Is that the only excuse?" and then they say, "Well, yeah, you know, we just got to have it because of this statute." So, well, where's the regulation for that? Well, we don't care where the regulation is. Well, you better care. Now, then, they're opening themselves up for a lawsuit.
Well, I think you gave a lot of people another step. There's some people that I know right now that are looking for options to maintain their privacy. And by the way, folks, privacy is not a bad thing. It doesn't mean you're evil and you're doing something nefarious. It just means that you are not wanting to participate in something that is not mandatory but purely voluntary, and you don't feel like to be adversely affected by putting yourself out there and putting your underwears up in public. So my understanding is the state can't make that which is voluntary under federal law something which is mandatory under state law. Is that how you understand it, John?
Yeah, the feds has got a lot of problems enforcing any kind of law in a state if you get right down to it. It has to have something to do with commerce or some kind of something like that. That's their only police powers really in the state.
All right. Well, I'd like to, John, if it's all right to you, I'm kind of exhausted my questions. Do you mind that before we bring Ed on, we see if there's any questions address to your subject matter specifically?
Yeah, I'm ready.
All right, guys. Anybody got any questions for the subject matter so far for John? Wow.
That means we explained it. That means we explained it perfectly.
Did I hear someone trying to jump in there?
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment or two. I understand there's a difference between a public account and a private account. Private bank account, you don't need even to give them ID of any kind. And, of course, no tax numbers or anything of that nature. It's like a Swiss bank account, which the numbered accounts, which is accessible only by the number. And so I'm wondering if you are familiar with those at all.
I'm not, no. But I can see how that would be easily done because, you know, if you've got the number, that's all they really want anyway. I mean, I've had checks go through without signatures and everything else. They don't want anything. Just present it.
Yeah, the beauty of the private account is, of course, it's not taxable, and you can also make a what do you call those deposits? It's not a general deposit, but a
special deposit.
Special deposit, yeah. So that if you deposit silver dollars, they have to return silver dollars instead of Federal Reserve notes. So, but that's all I've heard about it. I mean, there's rumors that abound, but I have never seen anyone actually having opened one.
Me either. I don't know of anything about it. Most, I mean, there used to be a few privately held banks here in Texas. There was two of them within about 25 miles of me, and they've long since gone by the wayside. But they were privately held banks up until about 1970 or so.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, George. You got any questions for John or just had that comment?
Yeah, I was just wondering if he knew about private banking, but apparently it's still a closely guarded secret. So I don't know where you're going to find the research to find that information.
Well, thank you. I think just to speak for – I'm not speaking for John, but speaking about what I heard him say, we're a lot closer – to discovering a private banking scenario with the information we learned tonight than we were before we started. So we'll just have to come back and re-listen to the recording and try to extrapolate. John read us word for word a letter he used to perhaps do something very similar. He said it was a house loan, John, that you got without providing these particulars. Is that correct?
You're kind of cutting out there, Daniel.
Sorry, I said, was it a house loan that you acquired without the SS number?
Yes.
House loan.
I had a loan with the first company, and they sold it to the second company, and then the second company was the one wanting the Social Security number.
I see. So we've got some information.
Daniel, I had one other time when I was working for a company and the insurance company changed, and the new insurance company, hospitalization, wanted my Social Security number. And so, you know, they wanted it on the application, and I just didn't provide it. So they started, you know, taking the premiums and all that stuff. Nobody ever said anything. And then several months goes by, and my wife had to have a little bit of surgery. And I told her, I said, well, these people are a-holes, so be sure and get everything approved and all that kind of stuff. So here comes the insurance company and said, well, we have to have your Social Security number before we can approve this stuff. I said, really? I said, well, why? And they said, well, we have to have a unique identifier. I said, well, if you want a unique identifier, just assign it to me, and I'll use it. And so they said, well, we usually use your Social Security number. I said, yeah, but in this case, you're not going to usually use it. You're going to assign me a number. And I said, and this has all been self-approved, and here's the other side of the story. You didn't need my Social Security number to take the premiums, and you've been taking them quite regularly. So that took care of the issue, and in about 15 minutes, they call back with a unique number that involved my birthday, and they and that's the way we went forward after that. So.
Well, you're such a meanie. I bet you had that clerk crying in tears, crocodile tears.
No, I just killed them with common sense. They want me to have a unique identifier. Give it to me.
Anybody else got a question for John on the subject matter before we move on?
Daniel, I wanted to see if he wouldn't mind repeating that 26 CFR regulation or code that he just – I didn't get it all, and I just wanted to make sure. The very last one. No, the last one that you mentioned regarding that they have to have the regulation, or that you don't have to abide by. If they don't have a regulation, you don't have to abide by the statute.
Okay, that's in they've got it. The statute is in at 5, Title 5, United States Code, Section 552, and there's various different shades of it. Now, the Secretary of the Treasury published their requirements under Title 26 that they have to publish. It's located at 26 CFR Part 601, Section 601-702, I believe it is. Hang on just a second.
I believe it is exactly right.
Yeah, 601.702.
And that's lowercase a2 double I?
It's lowercase a, number two, and then two small i's.
All right, we will find that. Good recap. Thank you for that request.
I have a question.
Go right ahead, dear.
Yes, are the credit unions that are state-run and not federally insured any better than banks?
I think that John, I think all credit unions are federal, aren't they?
Yeah, that was my
understanding. They all have FDIC insurance. I know that. They're not self-insured.
There might be some private credit unions you might be referring to versus federal credit union.
Yes, private.
That's true. Now, I used to deal with a private credit union for the railroads, and they had their own, they had their own loan people and everything else, and they didn't have. Now they might have got their original funding or something like that through some type of program with the federal government, but basically all it took to form up a private credit union was like seven people with $5 a piece or something. I mean, it was bizarre as to how lax it was.
Listen, this is your opportunity. You've got John on the hot seat, willing to answer your questions. It's a momentous occasion. Don't leave this time without your questions answered. Anybody else?
DJ, can you hear me?
Yes. Are you addressing a question to John or DJ?
Well, I got on a little. Is it regarding bank accounts? Because I got on.
Yes, our conversation is banking without an SS number and private banking, and yes, that's the conversation thus far. We got more coming, but that's what we're doing right now.
Okay. I would just chime in that I had a bank account. I actually got a couple of them without a Social Security number. And one, they made me close, but the other two, I think, I have two that are still open. And Albert Barcroft taught me how to do that back in 2015. So there is, if I remember correctly, there is no law that they say they have to ask you for a Social Security number, but you don't have to provide one. The problem is becoming where they don't allow you to open the bank account if you don't have it, or in one of my cases, they shut it down like 6 months later. To open them, I've opened two, and I have two open right now without a Social Security number. I have the laws. They're in written in Al's book, where they, you know, they can ask you, but you don't have to provide it. Because for most of us, the Social Security number is the sign of the beast, and it's against our religion. It's against our religion, so they can't make us provide them with a Social Security number.
John, I'm going to go over that a little bit later. I got the laws. I'll be explaining those a little later.
I got them, too.
Good to hear from you.
Well, I tell you, just for whatever it's worth, for anybody that's here on this call, as far as a personal testimonial, I've raised nine little children, nine offspring. They're all grown out of the house, I did it all without a driver's license and a Social Security number. Haven't banked since 1988, I believe, or 1987, as far as banking. Back in the days where they just had that passbook where you could put money in and take money out. If anybody's old enough to remember those. So I've lived my entire life thus far, and just approaching the top of the hill of 60 years of age, and have not participated with the Social Security number. In fact, I have a letter here from the Social Security Administration that I communicated with, and I was listening to Brother Dan Denham over there, and he was talking about he had gotten some letter from the Social Security Administration, so I sent the letter and said, I want one of these. And the Social Security Administration sent me a letter back, and the letter, in short, was a letter to any agency that I am not required to give the Social Security for religious reasons, the Social Security number for any reason whatsoever. So I have yet to go and take that letter and reattempt. Time and energy has forbade me from getting that project started again. But now with what John has shared in the community, with Title V, with the Federal Register, with the information from all of you folks out there, since John's already did it, and he said that Al Barcroft has it in his book, and I have Al's book, and I've got plenty of information on my in my camp, and knowing that that if they are required to, and they decide not to, it might be a, as John would call it, an SRO. A spontaneous retirement opportunity for them to discriminate against me. Now that I've got a religious objection acknowledged by the Social Security Administration, as well as the law that there is doesn't exist if it's not in the Federal Register, as John brought out tonight, it sounds like we're moving right along. For those that want to keep in contact about this and want to talk about it some more, make sure you stay part of our House of Prayer calls. And we, like I said, there's some. We have a lot of late people that showed up after the call already started. Our next call will be the 12th of May. We are skipping. We have it every 2 weeks normally. We're skipping a week because I will be doing a presentation in Florida on the 6th and 7th of May, and it's just going to be too much to try to put that call on that week. So, John, I will just give one more call out, see if anyone else has any questions for John.
Let him know that you got a copy of that letter.
I do have a copy of the letter. Do you want me to make that letter available, John?
Yes, it's a sanitized version.
Sanitized version of John's letter he read, and we will make that letter available online. Wow. Hallelujah and praise the Lord. That's quite a letter, and you guys don't realize what that's going to mean to you. There was a woman that had a question. Please forgive me for interrupting. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering if you can get ideas of how to rewind when you have your Social Security in the system, how to rewind it.
I'm not sure I understand the question, but if you understand, John, go right ahead. It was directed to you anyway.
I didn't understand it either.
If your Social Security is already in the system, a bank account, VA hospital, how do you rewind? How do you get it out?
She's asking if the account's already open, how do you take it off the account?
That's a pain.
Yeah, and they're not going to do that.
It'd probably be really hard.
You would have to close the account and open a new one.
Yeah, that's the fast way. Close it, open a new one.
I would recommend it in the reverse order. I would say open a new one and then close the old one.
Even better.
Sorry for being so practical. I can only imagine someone being over there not being able to access any banking because they're squabbling with the people about the use of the Social Security number. So I would say go open another account, take your practice, take your licks, go through your banks, find one that you can do business with privately, and then shut the other one down. Great question. Anybody else?
Use another name.
Thank you.
Yeah, I have a question. In the first place, I would look for a local bank. I wouldn't go to the national ones because the local ones would have a attorney there in case any legal question came up, and you could settle it right there and then. But my question is, all right, so you insist on no social. What if they come back and say, well, it's our policy not to open accounts without a social?
Then you're pretty much hosed right there because they're a, you know, if you can't force a business to do business with you. So you know, if they have a policy that they want to demand people's personal relationship with the government, then that's their policy. You can go hunt another bank, but you know, that's the hard part about dealing with private businesses and things like that. Now, if it was a school or somebody like that that's hooked up with the government, then you've got a better chance of getting what you want done. But a private business, I mean, I've you know, I explained y'all how I did that insurance company and things like that. So, you know, if they get started with the account with no Social Security number and then come back later, then you've got them, especially if you've been giving them money without the Social Security number. So, you know, if it's just private business and you haven't got your account open and they say it's their policy, then you're pretty much out the door, the way I see it.
Okay. On the other hand, they are open to the public. So would this not be a case of discrimination? Could you not sue them on that ground?
You could sue anybody in the world, anybody in the world that forces you to give a Social Security number.
Yeah, I would say you could sue them too.
I'm going to go over that later. It's against federal law, period. End of discussion.
I'm glad to hear that, John, because I was going to say earlier you made the statement something of the effect that banks are not private when they're actually acting an agency for the government. So are they like talking out of both sides of their mouth there? We're private, but we're not private. How does that work in your mind?
Yep, they are talking out of both sides of their mouth. They want to say that they're private, but they're regulated by the government. So that's kind of the way that relationship goes. The Federal Reserve is regulated by the government, even though it's privately owned.
Well, it sounds like we're Ed's chomping at the bit to share some stuff with us. So, any other questions for John? John, I'd want to once again appreciate your information, your education, your dedication, and your sharing on this call. Very much a blessing to the House of Prayer call. I just want to let the listening audience know that's we call him John from Texas. He's our travel, search and seizure, and money argument man, and that is an understatement of the year. So we so much thank you for that, John. And if it's all right with you, if you don't have anything else to add to that, I'll put Ed on.
Yeah, put him on.
All right, Ed. I know that you're raring to go, and everybody, this is Ed Seymour from Georgia, and he is the, he's the bull in the China cabinet when it comes to war. You do not want him in the
time. Yeah, you break it up.
You can't hear me?
Can't hear you, buddy.
I said, is this better? I'll get right down to the phone. Is this better?
That's a lot better.
All right, I don't know what's up with my phone tonight, but I'm not even touching it. This is Ed Seymour from Georgia. He's the bull in the China cabinet that you don't want to mess with on the subject of the law. He's going to talk to us a little bit tonight about some of the things he's been doing. He's brought some people on for testimonials, and we're so glad to have you on our call, as he's been on in the past. For those of you that missed the calls with Ed in the past, once again, you can go to myhouseshallbecalled.com. You can go to the call recording sections, and you can go and look and download or listen right online. And there is plenty of those calls where Ed has shared documents for your information. Ed, we're very thankful you're on the House of Prayer call tonight. It's all you.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure listening to John talk about the law and the IRS. He's a great speaker, and he knows a lot. I've learned a lot from him. I call him my private attorney. And he's also my chief negotiator. I've got three guys on the phone tonight. Steve from Florida, who got trespassed for a mask mandate, who had a recent run-in with the courts of Florida. I got Jonathan Gwynn from Texas, who was about to be thrown in prison if he didn't show up with a certified check at a sentencing hearing for $10,000. And I got Daryl from Alabama, who had a ticket for no driver's license, no insurance, and no registration. But I just want to tell everybody, I'm going to talk about the passport and also the Social Security laws regarding, the laws regarding having to hand over your Social Security number. But for anybody that wants to follow me with a passport, if you would, if you've got a computer in front of you, go ahead and look up the DS-11 form for your national passport. DS-11, just go ahead and get it up on your screen, page 4. There's 6 pages. Go to page 4. We'll start there when I come back. So for now, because I've got one of my clients is rushed for time, I'm going to introduce Jonathan from Texas. I met him. I'll just set up the intro, and then I'll let Jonathan take over with the story. He had come to Chris and I at Child Support Made Simple. He had already been sentenced in a bench trial. He'd been fighting this for years, custody battles, probably a good 16 years he's been fighting this fight. And he got to us. He had already been pronounced guilty in a bench trial, which ain't hard to do in a family court. And, he had the world against him. So he was told if he didn't bring a certified cashier's check for $10,000 at his sentencing hearing, which happened on April the 6th, that he was going to spend the next 6 months in prison. Jonathan is a fine guy. He's just in a bad situation. He loves his children. And with that, I'm going to bring Jonathan on the line so he can tell you fine folks what we did and what changed. Jonathan, you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Ed. And, I can't thank you enough. And I think the intro for Ed should be even bigger. You guys, I got a chance to listen to John a little bit. You guys are the real heroes. I've been railroaded for about 16 years, as Ed said. I got my son taken away from me when he was 4. I haven't seen him still to this day. Then they tried to railroad me for child support arrears. I was going to go public with a company. They put me in jail. I lost my company. I probably lost $100 million on that deal. Then they still come after me, and they still hunt me down. And, I was just running out of what to do, and I was facing jail. And I was scheduled to be sentenced for 6 months. And then after the 6 months, if I didn't pay the full $125,000 while I'm in jail for 6 months, I'm scheduled to stay there day for day till that money's paid off. So basically, I could stay in there till I die, is the way it's read. And, you know, and I didn't do anything. I didn't harm anyone. You know, and this, and they have no proof of the amount of money that I owe. And I just couldn't fight it. I just, you know, I'm just facing, and I'm still kind of facing it, but I used to be scared of the system. I was scared of the judge. I was scared of the Austin courts, and I was scared to face them. And then I talked to Chris, and Chris said, "Wow, we're a week away from you going, you're going to a sentencing." And I said, "I even got more scared." And he said, "I'm going to have to pass you to my partner Ed." And I got on the phone with Ed, and Ed read my stuff. He said, "Man," he said, "they railroaded you here." And he said, "I'll tell you what you do." And he immediately sent me some video, audio.
Tell them about the three attorneys first. What they did to you.
So I had my attorneys. I had the prosecuting attorney, and I had to fire every. The first thing Ed told me to do was listen to. I don't know if it was John speaking on that audio, but it sounded like John. But someone mentioned about firing all attorneys, prosecuting attorneys, your attorney, and so I fired everyone immediately. But during that audio, I actually gained my courage back and my pride because I lost it. I lost, you know, and I mean pride, but I mean like. You know, you feel defeated, and you feel defeated. Being defeated for so many years and losing your son is heartbreaking. You know, and it still has a hole in my heart that still hasn't been filled. And when Ed sent me an email, and I read through it, and he said, "You got to get this paperwork done." And I immediately went through it, and then I stayed up till 4 in the morning, and I did all three. Papers and I transferred them to my court hearing and made it fit my my case. The next morning, Ed was there and said, "Hey, we need to correct some things. We need to do this. We need to do that." And I filed everything. He said GSA bonds. They're supposedly. I thought they were for real estate. And you know, I filed everything that he said. I was scared in court again, but Ed. Just kept giving me the confidence. They can't put you in jail. They can't. You have rights. You know. And now I feel confident. I feel confident. And so I filed everything they said. And I never get a response. I always look up documents and I try to file all kinds of documents that I find on Scribd, as a website. You can find old court documents and stuff. And I never get a response. I mean, in less than 24 hours, when I filed what Ed told me to file, the district clerk reached out to me and reset my whole hearing. And she said, where I was scheduled to appear in person, they rescheduled it for me to appear by Zoom. Okay, because I was the reason I was supposed to appear in person is because I was supposed to get incarcerated that day. And instead, they changed it in less than 24 hours of me filing that paperwork, I had to go. All of a sudden, I was excited because I said, "Well, I'm not going to jail because I'm going to a Zoom call, a Zoom meeting instead of a Zoom hearing," and I was happy about that. But then Ed stuck with me through the trial. Ed stuck with me right there. The judge kind of still tried to railroad me, but he did not put me in jail. The prosecuting attorney insisted on putting me in jail twice to the judge, and the judge said, "I'm going to give him another 3 months to get it together or file," and he said this, "or file the correct documents to get himself out of this." And he told me that. The judge said, "Well, you got to file it properly because you're not filing it properly or we wouldn't be here." And, you know, I am so grateful for this guy. I've given me, you guys, all you guys that are doing this for guys that don't know, you know, because they've been railroading people for centuries, probably, you know, since who knows how long. And for once in my life, I actually feel confident that I'm going to get my life back, because for a minute there, I just couldn't breathe. And, you know, I had a television station, a television network that I had started from the ground up. I come from nothing. And I was about to go public, and these guys incarcerated me on a capious warrant, and I lost my company and I lost everything. And, you know, then they just, it seems like they just want to keep, and so I was going to get married. And then they, when they saw me about to get married, they filed the arrears and then they started threatening me again. Then they insisted I pay $3,000 a month. Well, I started the little money that I say, I started paying them $3,000 a month and I just couldn't, I just kept saying, and then my wife left me, the new wife left me because it's just too much problems for a new wife to have, you know, $3,000 a month is a lot of money when you're trying to build a life with all over. But now, even though she's gone, I have the confidence, I have the courage that I can walk in that courtroom and I can stay out of jail and I can fight my own fight without an attorney. I got God on my side, but I got God sent you soldiers like Ed and Chris and John and you guys that are on the phone. And there is justice, because for a minute there, for a long time, I thought there was no justice and it was an unfair system. But these guys that are on this phone call that are teaching people, you guys are the real heroes, and I'm in debt to you, Ed, for what you've done for me. And, you know, this guy is such a good guy. He hasn't even – I keep asking him, send me your Cash App so I can at least pay you something. He doesn't even send it, you know. And he knows that I'm facing – and he's like, oh, I'm going to help you. I'm going to get you – we got to file this. We got to file that. And I'm so grateful. But if you're facing that, you're in the right group right now, because these guys know what they're doing and they know how to fight this witchcraft. And I have a friend who's a judge and he admits it to me all the time. Well, it's draconian. It's draconian. That's what he tells me. And he tells me, I don't know what to tell. He doesn't tell me how to fight it. He just tells me, hey, you got to face it. It's a draconian system. That means it's an evil witchcraft, put you in slavery type of a game they're playing with you, and it's a word play, and it's you get scared and you get wrapped up in there and you lose yourself, and then you get emotional, and then when you get emotional, then they're ready to put you in the slammer because you don't know how to act, and they do it on purpose. They push your buttons, they send you paperwork threatening to put you in jail, threatening you with all this stuff. But now I'm not scared anymore because I know I got God and I got good people behind me like Ed. And poor Ed, I blow his phone up, and I know he's probably got 100 other people blowing his phone up, but he answers my call. He ends up calling me sometime, and I don't need an attorney, and I will never hire another attorney. I got Ed, and I got a good team now, and who, if you're facing it, put your faith in these guys. Lose the attorneys because they're just you're just involved in entrapment. And I'm not facing jail, and I'm out here walking free, and I stopped paying. I'm not paying anymore. And Ed told me, if you pay, you're getting back in contract with them. So stick to your guns, and that's one thing that's hard to do when you're facing it. You don't want to stick to your guns. You want to give in to that fear. Don't give in. Just do what they ask you and study and stay up all night and do what they ask. Whatever paperwork, read it and try your best to understand. I still don't understand it all, but I listen to him and I do exactly what he says, word for word, and every step. And even today, you know, I mean, they tell me, well, what do you want? We can't build your courage. You're going to have that courage. So I'm here to tell you guys, have courage, because you can stand up for yourself, and we have freedom, and we have rights, and we have liberties, and we are in America, and we can fight this ugly system that's made to enslave us. But with a little guidance and help from these godly soldiers, you can free yourself from their slavery. And I'm doing it now, and you know, I'm fortunate and blessed to have. I swear to you, I Googled and found Chris and Ed. And it was probably 5-6 days before my hearing. And literally, when I filed my paperwork, in less than 24 hours, they changed my hearing to a Zoom hearing, and they changed the judge, they changed the court.
They changed the file number.
They changed the case number. And I went and I was still scared. And Ed stuck with me, and he goes, "You're not going to jail, so you don't have anything to fear because you're at home. You're not in their courtroom. No officer's going to walk up and arrest you because you're in your home." And sure enough, the judge said, "All right, well, I'm not putting him in jail." He told the prosecuting attorney, "I'm not doing it, and we'll just have to see him in about 3 months and see if he's getting fine." And here I am. Ed's working with me to file more paperwork. And Ed said, "Oh, I mean, he's taught me to. I didn't know you could go get a copy of the judge's oath." So he sends me to the Secretary of State has just confirmed an email to me from both judges that have ruled against me, their oaths. I have a copy of their signatures. So Ed's getting ready to file this paperwork with their oath to obeying the Constitution. And they have not obeyed the Constitution. They have gone against me and taken my rights away against the Constitution. So I have their oaths now, and I can imagine what we're getting ready to file is going to wake them up a little bit, because I got their signatory contracts with the state of Texas promising that they're going to abide by the Constitution and defend the Constitution. They're not defending the Constitution. They're in a draconian system, and they're not lawfully obeying the law. They're taking advantage of people left and right, and we don't know it. We're just blind. We're just blind in the courtroom, and your attorney's not going to tell you. Your attorney's going to tell you sign the contract, because they all make money off you. But I'm grateful for Ed and Chris and all you guys that are knowledgeable in this. Knowledge is power, and I'm still learning. But believe me, I was in tears when I went to Ed, and you could hear it in my voice. I was a baby and fearful, and I'm not fearful anymore. And I'm not afraid to stand up to him now. And I'm ready to fight for my freedom. And I know I can. And
Jonathan,
if I can, any of you can. Yes, sir.
Jonathan, tell him real quick before you get off what happened when you sent the letter to the prosecutor and fired him. Tell him what changed there.
Oh, they stopped. They don't even text me. They don't even send me emails. They don't bother me anymore. They used to send me letters, you got to appear here, sign this. They don't even contact me. You can do this. Any of you on this phone call can do this process. If I can, you can. So we're all the same. And, we just don't know. And I'm so thankful for Ed and Chris and, you know, the rest of you heroes that I don't know about, because I heard on that audio this guy teaching me how to fire an attorney. I mean, he gives you, pardon my French, but I grew some balls listening to that audio. I was like, damn, I can actually fire these attorneys, and you can. You can fire them. And then I went through and did the GSA bonds, and that was complicated, but I stayed up all night. And in one night, I finished all the paperwork. It was a pile of paperwork. And I finished it, and the next day he looked it over and made some changes, and I filed it. And in less than 24 hours, I had a Zoom hearing instead of getting ready to be convicted to six months in their county jail in Travis County.
Do you think in retrospect that something alarmed them about your paperwork?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I appreciate you. I appreciate you coming on. You got anything else to say?
No, I'm just grateful to God. I'm grateful to you prayer warriors and keep fighting the good fight. And, one of the things that because my confidence is changing and my attitude is changing, I'm getting ready to open up another TV network, and things are starting to move along for me. And I feel like I'm going to get my life back, and I'm listening to Earl Nightingale's meditations, and I'm back on track, and I feel like I'm getting back on track, and I feel like I'm going to get my life back. So thank you, and I commend these heroes. You guys follow their lead. Don't be scared. They're not BSing. It's what they do is miracles, and a lot of people need them. And unfortunately, a lot of people in the past have just been, you know, probably still incarcerated because of the system. But these guys know how to fight the system. So I'm grateful and blessed to know you, Ed, and I thank you.
You too, John. Hey, Ed. I'm really proud of you. Yes, sir.
And send me your cash app.
Hey, Ed.
Oh, yeah, I will. Yes.
Can you hear me? I just want Jonathan to realize, since he wants to come on the House of Prayer call and speak French to us, I just want to let him know that not only the French people, but there's others that have balls too. So I'm glad he gave his testimony.
Yeah, I am too. He's obviously he's excited, but I mean, he's got a newfound purpose in life. And the thing about Jonathan is he's a prime example. This is a man that loves his children dearly, and he's being railroaded through this system. And that's why we have to end it. It's got nothing to do with anything but the money. That's all they care about is the money.
Yeah.
They're keeping families apart, and that's why I had Jonathan come on and speak tonight. I mean, I'm happy for his success and where he's at now versus where he was. He's in a new place now, and I'm really proud of you know, I was actually on the call. I was on the Bluetooth with him because he did a Zoom. So I was texting him what to say whenever they would come at him. But they still tried, even though he filed the paperwork and there was no way they could answer it. And to date, Jonathan, I don't think they have answered any of your paperwork, have they?
Nope.
Yep.
Nope.
And that's what I told him. They wouldn't answer it. So anyway, we're in good spirits there. Jonathan, I really appreciate you coming on. I know you got to go, buddy,
Thank you all. Thank you all, and God bless you all. If you're facing it, just stay in faith, and you're with the right group. So, I like I said, I'm going to help spread the word what you guys are doing. So I'm here if you need anything.
All right, my friend. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Okay, my second.
You,
we'll do questions at the end, hopefully. But my second guy is from Florida. His name is Steve, and Steve came to me. He got trespassed during the pandemic. A store owner from a mobile cellular phone retail store called the police because he refused to wear the mask. He was standing up for his rights. The sheriff's deputies show up, and within a minute, they had him in handcuffs. He had to go in. They bailed him out. He had run through his case pretty good before I actually got with him. But I got with him, and we filed some paperwork, and he's going to tell you his story next. Steve, you out there?
Yeah, I just unmuted.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Well,
hey, thanks,
go
Ed.
Ahead, buddy.
Okay, so you
don't
mentioned
forget
it.
To tell them, don't forget to tell them about the what you actually filed before you got to where you got today, okay?
Okay, you mean everything that I filed?
Well, not everything that you filed, just
I got you. I'm with you. I got you. Yeah, I got you. I got
okay.
you. I know what you're talking about. Okay.
All right.
So anyway, all right. Over a year ago, like 13 months, I was in a T-Mobile. I just went because it's a brand new location on my way home. So I stopped by there, and they told me I had to wear a mask, and I said I don't wear them. I declined, and so they called the police and the sheriff, and the sheriff called, and Ed wasn't exaggerating. With when you go back and look at the body cam footage, the police walked in the door, had a 12-second conversation with the store clerk, interrupted him, and walked over to me and basically said, this is the way it is. I have a rule. If you don't want to do it, you're going to be arrested. And the rule is that you wear a mask, or you're going to wear a mask. And I said, no, sir. And he said, hold on. He walked over and said, do you want him trespassed from the store? And he said, yes. He walked over and said, look, this is your only warning. If you don't put on a mask or leave, then I'm going to arrest you. And I didn't do it. I said, he said, are you going to wear a mask? I said, no, sir. He said, are you refusing to wear a mask? I said, yes, sir. And he said, grabbed my phone out of my hand, told me to turn around. He handcuffed me within 55 seconds. So he was coming there to arrest me. He knew he was. And that was the end of it. So I went to two jails that night, stayed several hours, and started this whole process 13 months ago. So Ed was correct. I had run through the court system, and I was just trying to find stuff online and trying to find any kind of resources to help me, because this is, I had never been arrested, never been in any kind of trouble. I just knew something wasn't right, and I wasn't going to put on a mask because I knew it wasn't the law, and I had the right to be left alone. Through Telegram, I found Ed, and through another gentleman that he had helped, and this, he went up and he just kept going on and on. I said, well, I don't have anything to lose. I might as well give Ed a call. So I called Ed. He was super busy. He almost didn't take me because at first he said he didn't know if he would have time to give me the kind of care that I needed because he was super busy. But he decided at the last minute to take me, and man, I can't tell you how blessed I am because of that. He started telling me, this is what we need to file. We need to file a bill of protection. We need to file all of these things and begin to go on offense where I had basically been on defense. So we started filing these things. We filed motions. I filed affidavits, motion to dismiss, all of these things that he told me they were going to ignore, and they did. Until the defense filed or the prosecutor filed a motion, then he wanted to go down to that line by line and get my acquiescence to it, which I didn't do. But so we go along. This thing kept going to the next stage. I had a jury docket day today, and I had long to go over before there became a time during this whole process when I realized, number one, for the first time in my life, I realized I wasn't a U.S. citizen. That blew my mind away. And I knew why I wasn't a U.S. citizen. And I knew that I was American state national, and I knew why I was. And so I wasn't afraid. They also put a charge of resisting arrest without violence because I refused to give them my name or any information. And so that was a charge that carried them. It was a misdemeanor charge, but it carried up to a year in jail. And the trespassing, they bumped it from a one to, or they filed it as a second degree versus first degree. So that would have been 60 days. It could have been 60 days in jail. And there was a time when I thought, man, I don't want to go to jail for a year over this stuff. And at one time I was thinking, man, I just need to plead guilty. But that lasted for about 5 minutes. And then I realized, and I started learning, and what Ed said today, because we had a conversation, and he said, what you got in this several-month process is an education. And that is a fact. One thing is Ed sent me volumes of stuff that I read and reread, but it also opened my mind up, and I would take something, and I would go looking for something, and I would just start being a sponge and trying to soak up as much as this. And I realized that the courts in these municipal courts are literally nothing more than crime syndicates, literally, that are masquerading as governments. And just, it is all about the money. And in this process, I realized, and I grew up thinking 100% opposite of that, which I think a lot of people did. I grew up in Texas, and I thought the police were all on my side, and I thought that judges were respectable, and I thought the courts, if you got involved in the court system, you must have done something wrong, and you probably got what you had coming. I had no idea. So this whole process opened my eyes. I knew today when we got to court, they always do the same thing. I'm always the last one there because they don't want me. They don't want to hear anybody, you know, seeing the questions, you know, that Ed, you know, had me present to the judge. So, but he comes in, first thing, he slams down my 568 pages of jury instructions that Ed had given me that I filed, and I hand delivered a copy of them to the judge's clerk. And it was loud. I mean, it's over a ream of paper, and he came down and slammed it down. And just the way that he was acting, because he's a pretty good-natured guy, I said, wow, this ought to be interesting. So 2.5 hours later, because I was the last one, always the last one, I come up to the podium, and he starts talking about, you're here on this matter, and you're still representing yourself. Is that correct? I said, no, sir, that's incorrect. I'm not representing myself. I am myself. And I have no representation. I'm defending myself. And he said, are you representing yourself? Yes or no? And I said, no. And he said, then he turned to the prosecutor and said, prosecutor, do you have anything to say? And the prosecutor said, at this time, the state is going, and I forgot the word that she used, but she's doing it. At this time, the state is not going to process this, or go forward. And the judge said, Mr. Horn, your case has been dismissed. And I was sitting there, I was hoping that would happen sometime along the way, but it actually happened today. And I know it had to do with a lot of different things, but they're not used to someone standing up. They're not used to someone challenging them in any way. The whole process, has made me, it's made me want to help other people in the same situation, but it's also made me realize that our government doesn't grant us rights. We created government because we already had inalienable rights. We already had natural rights and fundamental rights. They didn't give those to us. We already had those. And so, it felt great to leave the court today. There was a part of me that wanted to go in and get in front of a jury and do that, but I don't have to do that now, and I'm thankful that it's over. It's been, if you've ever been on the defensive side of any kind of a court battle, I've had a lot of sleepless nights. There's been a lot of, and then some people say, well, it's just a misdemeanor case, but it was a big deal to me, and I was facing jail time if I was convicted. So it was a big enough deal that it kept me up sometimes. But that's over. I can't tell you how happy I am that I met Ed, because he has been 100% for me. And I appreciate it, and I'm glad I'm able to publicly say that. So thank you, Ed, really.
Thank you, my friend. Thanks for letting these people know that you can beat them. As you can probably tell, Steve is he's a humble, meek person. He doesn't like conflict. But when he started learning the law and started realizing what they were doing to him, I mean, the tiger came out. I mean, he was on them step for step, standing there by himself. Actually, Steve, I think they also had the one of the AG attorneys there, right? They had the district prosecutor at one point, and they were saying, hey, we know it's a bad deal for you, but it's our job to prosecute you, stuff like that. They were goading him a little bit, and what the term Steve was looking for earlier was pro nosculi, which means for want of jurisdiction, they couldn't try the case. And so when Steve, which was key to his business, when he said, I'm not being represented at all, Your Honor, I'm here in my own proper person. I'm not being represented by anybody. I mean, they realized right then they wouldn't be able to lock him up because he didn't have an attorney. Now, if he'd have had an attorney, he would have lost. Do you agree with that statement, Steve?
1,000%.
Okay, and so that's what I'm trying to do with you guys coming on and speaking as to exactly what happened and the way you felt about it. This is stuff that they can't get, and the fact that you won it this morning, I really appreciate you at the last minute coming on and speaking with this group. This is a group of, godly people that want to take their country back. So I really appreciate you coming on tonight and speaking with the group. Does anybody have any questions for Steve before he goes?
Hey, I just want to say God bless Steve. But there's other sides to the story as well. So, how you doing, Ed?
Good, Perry. Glad you made it, buddy.
All right.
Thank you.
Anybody else?
Alrighty,
you gonna hang out, Steve? Y'all go ahead. Go ahead.
Could we see what the jury instructions look like? That'd be interesting.
Go ahead, Steve.
Well, he sent me more than I actually, we took out some, but it ended up being 568 individual jury instructions, which were one page each. And just I can't tell you how just reading through those, I read through them a couple of times, and it took quite a while, obviously, because it's literally 500, it's not like a book page, because you can just basically paragraphs, like 500 paragraphs. But it was all about different aspects of law and different elements of law. And so the time, you know, I read through 10 or 15 of them regarding the concept of willfulness, I had an understanding of what willfulness was. And because I was charged under a statute that included the word willfulness, I knew in my heart there was no way they could convict me. Because I had a perfect response to willfulness. So, just the knowledge and everything that was provided within those jury instructions. In other words, I have a right to instruct my jury because it is my jury, and they have the right to understand the law the way that I understand the law. So that was the whole concept behind that from what it explained to me. And it was, they didn't know what to do with that. That's obviously never happened to them. And I don't really know everything about why they decided to drop the case, but I have to believe that that was a piece of it, maybe a big piece, I don't know.
And,
well,
you know, I was
either way,
curious.
Yeah, go ahead.
How could they ever prove in personam jurisdiction if you've already got an affidavit on the record, that you're not the person of the statute? So are they not already missing an element? And could you not file a motion to dismiss for that they're not able to prove every element of the alleged charge? They're unable to prove, in essence, in personam jurisdiction.
Yeah.
They ignored
it
all.
In Florida, they don't use the word person in the statute that they charge me, but they use the word whoever. So, and that's a little, that, I dug into that and it became a little bit more tricky. But where we were going with it today and what it was I was prepared to do was to challenge them on the fact that the affidavit has been filed long enough that, number one, there's no evidence on the record that I am a U.S. citizen. I've already declared under penalty of perjury that I'm not a U.S. citizen and that I am an American state national, and they don't have any evidence on the record to otherwise. So unless they have evidence on the record, they don't have any jurisdiction to prosecute me unless I have actually harmed or injured someone, and there is no evidence on the record that I've done either of those things. So I was going to move today that they dismiss my case because of that, but it never got to that point. They dismissed it before we even got into that. So, what I was going to say is there were some questions that my appearance before 2 weeks ago really set the table, because the questions that I had that I got from Ed, and it revolved around pinning them down to forcing them to admit what kind of jurisdiction, or declare what kind of jurisdiction they had, because the question, the way that it goes through, says basically...
Stop just a second, Steve.
Yep.
Stop.
Okay.
I just want to tell them, before you tell them the story, that this part of the story is where you're going to hear him tell you that the judge ran off the bench in the last hearing. So go ahead from that standpoint, go ahead and tell them what you were asking and how you asked it, because the way you said it earlier was perfect.
Yeah. So when I first went in, I just I said, I just had a couple of questions. If I'm going to push this thing to a trial, I just have a couple of questions. And one, is this, you know, the matter before the court, is it, am I being tried under a criminal action, or is this a civil action? And they said, well, your charges are criminal. And so then I said, okay, let the record of the court then show this is a court is trying me under a criminal action. I said, well, I have another question. I said, the Constitution grants the court two different criminal jurisdictions. One is a criminal jurisdiction under the common law, and another is a criminal jurisdiction under admiralty or military tribunal venue from Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution. So in which one of these two criminal jurisdictions does this court intend to try me? And so he had, before this judge would, all he would, whenever he didn't want to answer something, he says, I don't answer legal questions. And he said, he did it again. He says, well, I don't answer legal questions. I said, well, I don't think it'd be, Your Honor, I don't think you'd be violating your oath of office if you did your duty under the Constitution. I'm not asking you for legal advice. What I'm asking you is for your legal intent. And he, that is when I got his attention, because I said, I have the right to appear as myself in my own person without a licensed attorney. And in order for me to, you know, intelligently defend myself, I have to know the jurisdiction of this court, what the court is operating under, because the rules of criminal procedure are much different for common law jurisdiction than they are for military tribunals. So and I said, you know, I have a right under the Sixth Amendment. It grants me a right to know what jurisdiction is being applied, and it grants you the duty to inform me. So I put him on note that he had a duty, and I was holding him to it. So I said, you know, you need to. I'm asking the court to answer the question and to properly identify itself. And then he was really flustered. He started looking at his laptop, and then he says, well, I'm going to, you're going to be under, you're being tried under the laws of the state of Florida. And I said, that jurisdiction, I said, well, there's no such thing as a criminal action under statutory jurisdiction. There's no jurisdiction established, and that jurisdiction is not established in the Constitution. So, I said, if you show me where it is or you show me where I can find those criminal procedures under statutory jurisdiction, and he said this courtroom is adjourned, and your appearance is blah, blah, blah. This courtroom is adjourned. And he just stood up, and I'm sitting there. I said, how can that happen right in the middle of, you know, he said, this court is adjourned and your next appearance is so-and-so. And he turned around and walked out. And I was just sitting there going, wow, I must have hit a nerve, because, but the point is that the court, he's a Article I court, and he has military tribunal. That's his jurisdiction. And so it put him in a place where he either had to admit that he was coming at me under admiralty, military tribunal law or venue, or he had to dismiss my case. And he didn't. He did it today, but he didn't. He just walked out of the courtroom last time, right in the middle of my appearance. So anyway, that's what happened.
Does anybody have any questions for Steve from Florida?
Just a comment.
Go ahead. Thanks, Dave. I was going to jump in there too and say, yeah, Steve, based upon what I listened to, and I've been at this a while, you've definitely got a handle on the head of the serpent there. It ain't wagging. It's, you don't got to bite the tail. It doesn't seem like it can bite you. So my thumbs up to your energy you spent studying. I wanted to comment when you were speaking about, and this might be a blessing to you. This is Daniel, by the way. I'm just a moderator of this call that we enjoy. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, you're coming.
Because I have problems. Yeah, good, because there's problems with my phone. I just want to make sure. Because I'm really tickled about your standing your ground about the representing yourself issue. And one of the things that I don't know a lot, but one of the things I believe that I know is that
agency requires you being in a representative capacity. And here's where it gets really interesting. I tell people that I personally know a story about a man who stood up there, knees knocking, and in a case where he was being charged in a federal willful failure to file.
Sound mumbled.
You mumbled? Seriously? I don't know what's wrong with this phone. Okay.
You're better now.
I know of a fellow that was in a willful failure to file case, knees knocking. And by the way, if I start mumbling, tell me, because I'm just sitting doing the same thing. I haven't moved. It must be a storm coming in the Arkansas area where I'm sitting.
Okay.
Anyway, this fellow sat there, knees knocking, and he maintained, "I'm not that person," when they called the case and they started to attempt to get joinder. At that moment in the case, he held his ground. And the judge turned to the prosecuting attorney and said to him, this may sound really familiar because I told this story before, but it sounds almost like what happened to you, and said, you got anything to say about this? And the prosecutor went bananas. And the judge basically called down the prosecutor, calmed him down, said, you either have evidence that he's the person that's charged or I'm going to dismiss this case. Do you? And the prosecutor said, I do not, Your Honor. Bam! This case is dismissed. So I've contemplated on that story for many years as I thought about it under Rule 9, where we talk about the capacity to be sued. And I remembered that when you said, I'm not representing, or you represent yourself, and you maintained that you are not representing anything there, I was remembering that I'm sitting here that it was revealing to me, I wrote my questions, both of those things have to do with a question that reveals to the court whether or not the prosecuting attorney has jurisdiction or has a responsibility to defend the property of the state. On the Illinois Attorney General website, there used to be, I don't know if it's there anymore, and someone can tell me if they know, but it was a site called the History of the Attorney General, and there it described that the Attorney General's history was to protect the interest of the Crown historically. Now, in the United States, the Crown is the state, so the Attorney General is there to protect the interest of the state. If you're coming in there representing, then you're acting an agency, and all property is vested in the state, bam, the Attorney General has jurisdiction, and we have a party. And that's how I see it. So that's just the way I see it, and it just really encouraged me. And if you all don't see it my way, that's okay. I don't want to argue with anybody. But, Ed, I was really encouraged about that story. Thank you for bringing them on.
Yeah, well, I mean, the one that should be proud here is Steve, because he made that judge literally run off the bench. He backed him into a corner, and the judge knew what he was doing, and he left. So that's that. Kudos to Steve. I mean, I did tell him that earlier. I said, what you really paid me for was a quick education, and that's the way it worked out for Steve. But now, see, Steve's in a position where he can go help his fellow man. I mean, he owns the paperwork, and Steve knows exactly how it works now. And, you know, as we get more and more people understanding what's actually taking place with these clerks masquerading as judges, you know, we're going to start changing our universe, you know, in the nation. And Steve was a big proponent after he read all the exhibits in my No Such Thing as a U.S. Citizen argument. Once he read through that and understood it, I mean, it was like being a new man, wasn't it, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, once I saw that that I wasn't a citizen, and that that they were presuming that I was, and it was nothing more than that, and they had no evidence to the contrary. I mean, I felt like a new man. I felt like I felt bulletproof, really, to be honest. I didn't feel bulletproof if I actually harmed someone. I would expect to be prosecuted. But I knew I hadn't harmed anyone, and I felt bulletproof because I knew that they couldn't touch me legally. And I knew if they railroaded me, that I would clean their clock in federal court and still plan to, because I was incarcerated. And according to this Tampa versus Tresvant versus the City of Tampa, my time's worth at least $62,000 an hour, and they kept me for many hours. So I fully expect to follow Title 43, Section 19, Title 42, Section 1983. So anyway.
By the way, when Steve came in today, when he came in today, when the judge came into the courtroom today, what he slammed down on the counter was Steve's 568 jury instructions. Which we figured.
I will never forget that.
Steve, this is John. Do you think the judge today was resigned to the fact that he was going to dismiss the case? Did he show any body language or anything like that, that he knew this case was over?
This is the case number and this is here and you're still representing yourself. And is that correct? And I said, no, Your Honor, I object. I'm not representing. And I went into that. His facial expression, just everything about him, his demeanor changed. And then he just looked at me and very sternly said, are you representing yourself, yes or no? And I says, no. And then he turned immediately to the prosecutor and said, prosecutor, do you have anything to add? And then that's when. So in my mind, I think he was, I think the appearance before that, he knew that I was going to come back probably after that same line of questioning and force him to admit his legal intent and what jurisdiction he was going to try me under. And he dismissed my case. So I don't know. I can't prove it, but the way he looked at me and the way he said.
Yeah, that's good. That's what I wanted to know there. You put him in such a corner that he had to bail over to the prosecutor, and the prosecutor didn't have anything. So there was nothing to do but for him to dismiss. So he was waiting for you to take that same position again, and then he didn't have any choice.
So yeah, I should have done it earlier, but you know what? If they'd have been dismissed day one, I wouldn't have this education right now, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. I could have gone to jail, and I said, you know what? I came to a point that I thought, you know what? If I go to jail, I go to jail. If I go to jail, then I can work nonstop or as much as possible on my next, on my lawsuit. But I wasn't backing down. I came to a point when I knew I wasn't backing down. I knew that I was right. I knew that at the time, the politics wasn't on my side because people were still going gaga over the COVID bullcrap. But that's changed 100% since then. And I know that they knew that there was no way a jury of my peers was going to find me guilty for something so ridiculous as not wearing a mask that wasn't even against the law to begin with. So anyway.
Yeah, that's the problem with that thing. They don't have a law they can point to that you violated. That's why they had to do the trespassing.
Exactly.
May I ask Steve if he's willing to help someone else in another state that had an arrest for no mask?
Well, I would say that I wouldn't know the law necessarily in the other state, but I would certainly be willing to put in what my experience was. But my recommendation would be to talk with Ed because he's the one. Anything that I know, I learned from him or someone that he directed me to. So I'm not an expert, far from it in any way, but I would be more than happy to listen to your situation and give you and find out how far along you are, and if there's anything I can do to help you, I would certainly do it. Absolutely.
Yeah, and would I be able to get a copy of the 560-plus page of Jordan?
All 572 of them would apply to you because the ones he took out were concerning females only.
Yeah.
So they would all apply to you.
And I identify as a male, so.
Okay.
Okay. Yes, we'll figure that out. That's one of my best kept secrets, but we pulled it out in Steve's case because they were really trying to railroad him when we started.
Yeah.
And they'll do the same to you. You got to understand, once the emperor has no clothes, folks, they turn around and run. Steve literally ran that judge off the bench 2 weeks ago. Just asking simple questions, and you hear his mild manner. I would pay money to be able to talk like Steve does in court. He's a natural.
It was really fun. I mean, I was floored. I was flabbergasted, and I'm just looking around, and the bailiff says, "All rise." And well, I was the only one in the courtroom other than the staff, and it was I can't even explain it. I can't believe that that certain questions phrased a certain way would bring that kind of response. So I would definitely share those questions with you. And I don't know, Ed, are you handling, are you helping this lady?
Well, what I'm going to do is ask Daniel, because he probably knows who she is, to to get her in touch with you. And I'll send Daniel your email.
Yeah, you can send Daniel my email, or you can send her my phone number. I don't care.
Okay, I'll send her your number and your name.
Okay.
Your full
name. Good. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, now I've got to go. My wife's leaving for Memphis tomorrow, so I've got to go walk my dogs. We do that every night together. So I'm about to leave the call, and I hate to do that, but I have a prior engagement. So thank you, everybody.
Steve,
for being
they
on
meet.
The call,
they meet every 2 weeks.
Oh,
they
perfect.
Meet every
okay.
Two
next,
weeks. Yeah, you can come back.
Next call's on the 12th of May, Steve, because we're skipping a week next week.
Gotcha.
12th of May.
Okay, I will be on it. Thank you very much. And
yeah,
man,
if we get
you
your email, we'll go ahead.
Warriors.
And. Yep. Thank you for being on the call. If we get your email, we'll make sure that you're given the email notification of the calls. Thanks again.
Perfect. Thanks. Thank you so much. Bye now.
Okay. Okay. So anyway, I'm super proud of Steve, and I'm super proud of John before him, and this next guy I'm really proud of too. I don't know if he was able to make the call. I sent him the number. He did contact me. Daryl from Alabama, are you out there? He's the only one that I wasn't sure if he would make it or not. Daryl, can you hear me? Well, I guess he didn't make it. Okay, so I'm going to wrap this up, folks, by telling you this. I found a case because it always bugged me. I knew that they couldn't prove jurisdiction on the record, but I'd never had a case that I could wrap my arms around, and I found the case. And I shared it with Daniel earlier today, so he has a copy of it. But essentially, this is what I'm going to tell you. This case is from 1933, and the case is O'Donohue versus United States, 289 U.S. 516, shepherdized down to 53 Supreme Court 740 from 1933. And this is what it says. Furthermore, in O'Donohue versus United States, the U.S. Supreme Court carefully considered the role of judicial courts authorized by Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution and compared them with the role of administrative or legislative courts authorized by Articles 1 and 4 of the U.S. Constitution. And I'm going to pause right there and tell everybody, if they don't know this already, I think most people do know this on the call, but you're in an Article 1 court created by the legislature. So we got a separation of powers issue between the legislative and judicial branches of our government. Okay, they're all commingled now. So Article 1 basically, Article 1 and Article 4 represent admiralty and maritime jurisdictions, or as John likes to refer to them, ad hoc jurisdictions. And I actually agree with John's interpretation because these jurisdictions, they just kind of make the rules up as they go along. After what it said was an exhaustive review, the U.S. Supreme Court made this incredible statement. Quote, as the only judicial power vested in Congress is to create courts whose judges shall hold their offices during good behavior, it necessarily follows that if Congress authorizes the creation of courts and the appointment of judges for a limited time, it must act independently of the Constitution and upon territory which is not part of the United States within the meaning of the Constitution. End quote. These statements of stare decisis law from the U.S. Supreme Court should make it perfectly clear that the administrative laws of the United States have no inherent or plenary authority within the 50 sovereign states of the Union. Now, does anybody have any questions about that case? Did everybody understand what, does everybody understand what independently of the Constitution means?
No.
It means without the Constitution.
What?
Go ahead.
What was the quote, Ed? 53 Supreme Court, what?
53 Supreme Court, I'm sorry, it's 289 U.S. 516, and that goes down to 53 Supreme Court 740.
Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, 289 U.S. 516 and 53 Supreme Court 740 from 1943. O'Donohue is spelled O apostrophe capital D-O-N-O-G-H-U-E. O'Donohue versus United States. And the funny thing is, because these guys know I've been working on this no such thing as a U.S. citizenship argument for a couple of, for a while now, maybe a couple of months. And I found this case law in a book called Legal Basis for the Term Non-Resident Alien. So I figured out this much. There is no difference between a non-resident alien, an American state national, which these two gentlemen you just heard from tonight recognize themselves at, as, and the state citizen who was part of the original 13 colonies. Out of those three types, they're all the same. They all mean the same thing. Without the United States, 8 U.S.C. 1746, paragraph 1, or 1 in parentheses, what I meant to say. So, anyway,
that'd be 28.
I'm sorry, 28 U.S.C. 1746. Why can't I say that? In parentheses, 1. Anyway, where was I? It must act independently of the Constitution, which means without the Constitution, and upon territory which is not part of the United States within the meaning of the Constitution. You know, I had told Daniel and David and John when I first met them on this call that we were actually in some type of regional federal martial tribunal territories and that we were not in the states. And now this case proves that. It proves that fact. I was correct in my assumption after studying the Constitution. That's exactly what we're in. We're in a federal territory,
now,
a district that expands with its citizens.
I mean, doesn't this, in essence, is a case that proves they don't have territorial jurisdiction?
They don't have any inherent or plenary power whatsoever. It's all administrative.
Okay. You know what I find, though, is happening that once that's challenged, what is going on during the case is basically arguments over address. And they're trying to get addresses on the record. They're trying to get zip codes on the record, you know, along with the whole sticking it in the docket that you're pro se, even though you've got an affidavit that says you're not pro se, they stick that in there too. And the issue of objecting, they try to deny the ability for you to object because they stick it in there. They stick it in the docket entry, and then after the hearing, it shows up in the docket entry. And then on the next hearing, they schedule the hearing in not enough time to be able to notice up any documents. And they say, well, no, you can't notice any documents because you didn't fail to notice up.
You seem to be a learned man. What is your name, sir, your first name?
This is Dale. My name's Dale.
Okay, Dale, my name's Ed. I'm from Georgia. Nice to meet you. I got three things to say to what you just said. Number one, I wholeheartedly agree with you, but I'm going to tell you how I defeat those arguments that you just listed, every one of them. And this is what I tell them. I read this case, or a case like it. McNutt versus General Motors Acceptance Corporation is a great case from 1936, which says the asserter has to prove jurisdiction once it's been challenged on the record. That came from John. John found that for Chris and I. And when we started using it in these child support enforcement cases and a couple of the CPS cases, it's just wreaked havoc for them. They can't answer it because that takes the judge out of play and they can't collude with each other to railroad you. The second thing that you talked about was the address. And the third thing that you talked about was them putting let's call it misleading or false information into the court record. So this is the way that I deal with that, okay? I quote them, I find the statute, because there's one in all 50 states, where if anyone puts false or misleading information into a court record, it is a felony. And we write an affidavit to that fact. Well, I don't care if it's the judge. I can't tell you how many times I've told a judge on the bench, Your Honor, I just want to stop and make the court aware that it's a felony to lie from the bench. And I will not tolerate it. Don't do it again. Another thing that I like to say, or when you're talking about the address specifically, is that, you know, whenever I'm asked where I live, I tell them I live inside my body. I'm only a citizen of the kingdom of heaven. Daniel says, or not Daniel, but David says all the time, I'm an indentured servant of heaven, of God Almighty. I'm an indentured servant. I can't serve two masters.
Well, here's how they do it.
What I say to them, I'm sorry.
Here's what they do. Okay, they'll ask you a question with the word address in the question. Okay. The proper objection would be objection assumes facts not in evidence. But most don't do that. Even somebody who knows that's what you're supposed to do can still step into it and say, if you say anything, if you say, no, I don't live at that location, or anything at all, you've already answered a question, even though you denied the question. It assumes facts not in evidence that you have an address, and it appears that they're operating off the word address. And I come back and ask, is the address that they're trying to obtain the same as that of a resident of the state? And it actually is, because that's the only addresses they can talk about. They only talk about, I believe they can't even talk about any location within the 50 several states. When they're talking about addresses, they're always talking about within their federal zone or federal.
Can I add to your statement?
Go ahead.
Is if you actually do in-depth research on jurisdiction, the courts have repeatedly stated is that jurisdiction is conferred by citizenship and not by residence and habitry or domicile. That's why you never even record any kind of domicile as a public record, because that also nails you into the synonymous term of U.S. citizen. And that's where, and also you can use the religious belief arguments. No, because I'm a born-again Christian, I'm a sojourner. It says that I'm a foreigner here. I don't use the term address. I don't use domicile. I don't use resident. I don't use any of those terms.
Does one ever use location? You have to realize that if you're arrested and you try to bond out, okay, they require a bond out address, and they'll require a social security number too, by the way. And then you got to go back and fix those. You got to get rid of them, basically, you know, do a rescission on them. But then they could try to revoke the bond and throw you back in jail if you try to do a rescission on a bond. So the whole thing gets very, very tricky. Then what they try to do is they try to send you, they'll put it in the docket entry that they're going to send mail to you, because they're going to give you what's in the docket. And you have to realize you can't violate, once they've arrested you and you bail out, you can't violate any of the rules of the court. So there possibly is a risk that if you reject the mail and you turn it back, to them. I give them like what Ed has in his documentation, where you don't use a zip code and you say in care of. But the clerk of the court will still convert it, and then they'll still send you mail with the zip code, and they'll still send you mail without the in care of. And so then if you don't return it back, then they'll put it in the docket that you were sent mail to the address that you gave them. Well, that's not the address you gave them. I gave a location with the in care of, but what they'll do is they'll they'll put it in the docket that I sent an address. They sent the mail to an address. So what they're doing is they're using the docket to build evidence against the person when the prosecutor is supposed to prove, but the judge and the is using the clerk to do it along with the judge. The judge is doing it too. So they're loading up the docket, and then you've got to object to the docket, and then they don't allow you to object timely because the docket is written after you leave the courtroom, and then they'll set the next hearing so that you can't notice any documents up. If you try to put a written objection in, the judge will actually say, "I had this happen," and the judge in the court, he'll say, you failed to notice up the document. And, well, that's the very issue, is that there's not enough time to notice it up. And then they deny the recording. So you're objecting that they denied the recording. They're doing this every time. They deny the recording. The hearing that they set right after the last hearing, where they basically stick all this false stuff into the docket. So they're building a docket.
Which state are you in?
The people.
What state are you in?
Yeah, it's in Missouri. Right, it's a circuit-level judge. So the guy's a master of what he's doing. He's an older judge, and he's got all kinds of tricks. And many of them is where they'll ask a question, and you can't really answer the question because if you don't say objection, assume fact's not in evidence. The other thing is what I'm finding is that even though one is exercising a right, you claim a right and then exercise the right, the judge will turn around and ask a question. And in other words, he's trying to get you to agree. And they can actually nullify your rights by your agreement. And I don't know how to deal with this subject. They're doing it almost all the time now. I'm exercising a lot of rights. And then what they're doing is they're asking a question which basically works to nullify the rights that you just exercised.
I'll tell you what
the gentleman was saying
before we move on, Darren, on the subject. I think that maybe since Ed has chomping at the bit and he had something to share tonight, maybe he'll address some of those things. Can we come back to that subject and see if maybe Ed might address some of those things in his presentation? I'm thinking he might
have
something.
Not a problem.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that this is the subject matter that he wished to speak upon. And so rather than giving any more to
drag
that right this moment, I ask.
Or make it for another call or something.
Well, I think he's going to talk about it, but am I incorrect, Ed?
No, I am going to talk about it. Before I get started with the passport thing, the five-star passport, do you have those two experts on the line here tonight?
Let's see.
The two guys you were telling me about earlier?
Let's see. Well, I said experts. One of them said he couldn't make it, and I'm not sure if the other's on here, but let me look real quick.
Okay. If not, then I'll save it till the next time.
Yeah, they're not. The one I know for a fact he wasn't going to be. Well, he might be. Harold, are you on? He said it'd be 8:30 before he could possibly be on, but I don't see him.
Okay.
And
I agree also with Ed's contention, what he was saying earlier about the citizen, whether a state citizen, U.S. citizen, American, state national, which really there's no such term. It's American national, but it means the same thing as a U.S. citizen. But anyway, I just wanted to bring that part in.
Ed, did you have? Were you ready to in the middle of a presentation?
Did he just say that American national was the same thing as a U.S. citizen?
All right, now we're on. There is your platform, Darren. Darren was going to share this information in a presentation about a week ago.
But I'm not sitting on my computer.
Well, you know what, Darren? I've never known you to back down from opening your mouth and sharing.
I'm not sitting on my computer. That's all. I'm not sitting. I don't have that information in front of me. Like we were doing it last time. No, but the thing is actually you can go back to Halsen versus Germany in 1925, and they basically, even that international court said that U.S. Nationals were the same as American nationals. They fit into that category. You could go into, you know, the federal statutes at large, volume 66, 101, A21. Also look at A36. It talks about the different types of nationals. And there was somebody who was bringing in they mentioned that the term state meant a foreign country, but technically it didn't, because if you look further into that statutes at large, it refers to it as a foreign state, not a state, but a foreign state. And remember, the state is spelled two different ways. There's capital S and then there's small s. But go ahead. Ed. You do question, your presentation.
My question was simple. I think that he said that a United States national was the same thing as a United States citizen, or a U.S. national was the same thing as a United States citizen. So
it's similar. It's very similar because it still keeps them underneath that same umbrella, let's say.
Okay, so I'm going to open some eyes tonight. So for those of you that heard me earlier, I said, please bring up the DS-11. And what I figured out is a bulletproof way to get a five-star passport right out of the gate. And I've got people right now, some people that are on the line with me, some in different teams that I'm associated with that are actually trying this, and they've already heard this, but I'm gonna tell you guys what I did. Basically, I did a business process letter to the United States Department of State, Secretary of State, Bureau of Consular Affairs, and to my local Bureau of Consular Affairs here in Atlanta, Georgia.
I sent you an email.
And I sent a letter. I'm sorry? I sent a letter to them about a week before I went to get my passport, which happened this past Tuesday at 1 o'clock. And what I noticed was that on this, we call this the needle in the haystack. Okay, that's what I refer to it as. But if you look at page 4, which is the first page of the application for a U.S. passport on the DS-11 form, it says at the top, U.S. Department of State application for a U.S. passport. Okay, at the top right, you'll see what looks like a label space. And then in the rest of the form, you'll see where it's got these little white boxes where you enter information. But underneath that label at the top right, that white space label that looks like a label at the top right, it's got the following four letters. It's got a D with a checkbox, an O with a checkbox, an S with a checkbox, and an NFR with a checkbox. We don't care about those. What we care about is what's underneath those checkboxes. So what's underneath it is the word END, capital END, period, with a number sign and a line, but no white space. And then over to the right, it's got EXP dot period, or EXP period, and then a line for expiration. Well, I figured out that END period does not mean end. It's another word, and that word is endorsement. And that is where you put the endorsement codes that you will find in the Foreign Affairs Registration Manual, which you can find on the U.S. Secretary of State's website. It's located at fam.state.gov. But they don't have it. They don't have any white space, so it's like you're not supposed to put anything there, but I'm gonna tell you guys why you do want to put something there. So if you go to 505, actually it's 8 FAM in capital letters, 505.2, you're going to come up, the first hit you're going to come up with is something called, you're going to see at the very top of the page and the very bottom of the page, it says unclassified. And it says passport endorsements under the 8 FAM 505.2. So if you go down the page about halfway, and I've highlighted the actual. So here are the definitions. Endorsement means an official stamp, type, or written indication of the circumstances under which a passport was issued or can be used. The bearer may also be provided with an information notice that provides more information on the endorsement. Endorsed passports indicate three different things: that they are valid for a specific period of time, that the bearer has a certain status, and that there is some other relevant information about the bearer of the passport. B, supervisory consular officers abroad and directors of passport agencies and centers must ensure that endorsements are processed correctly. You must use the standard wording given for each endorsement. C, I'm skipping around here a little bit. You must use the specific endorsements prescribed for the situation at hand. The use of a non-standard endorsement or incorrect use of a standard endorsement may cause confusion, problems for the traveler, or inappropriate action and subsequent adjudication. Uniform use of the endorsements will avoid such confusion and minimize the need to retrieve and review previous passport files. D, specific guidance about the use of endorsements is provided in the corresponding subject instructions at 8 FAM. The endorsement code must be noted in the appropriate space on the passport application. Again, I bring your attention to the DS-11 form and where it says END period and the number sign and the line. E, see 8 FAM 706.1 for specific information on using endorsements with passport cards. So everybody knows you can either order a passport or you can order a passport and an ID card. Okay, so let's go to the codes. 8FAM505.2-2, list of current endorsements. Last updated on February the 7th, 2022. So they have endorsements that include the... So first, they have a broad category of the specific types of endorsements you can get, and here they are. D, which means diplomatic passports. CD, which means courtesy diplomatic passport. CARD, which means the passport ID card. O means official passports. N means no-fee regular passport. R means regular passport. S means service passport. And all, the word all, A-L-L, means all types of passports. So I'm going to cut to the chase, and I'm going to go to 08 and 09, code 08 and 09. By the way, there are 116 codes, and they cover just about everything you can think of. But nobody tells us this stuff. So 08, the endorsement code 08, the bearer is also known as K through A given names or K through A surname. Bearer uses an assumed name in addition to his or her legal name. Well, who does that sound like? That sounds like a U.S. citizen. Okay, and here's 09. The bearer is a United States national and not a United States citizen. I'm going to repeat that again for my friends. The bearer is a United States national and not a United States citizen. Placed in a passport book issued to a U.S. national who is not a citizen. U.S. national will be printed instead of USA on the front of the passport card. Prior to the creation of this endorsement in 1992, which incidentally lines right up with 8 USC 1456B1, prior to the creation of this endorsement in 1992, the bearer's status as a non-citizen U.S. national was indicated by circling the word national or crossing out the word citizen in the secretary's message on the signature page of the U.S. passport, which you'll find on page 4 of 6 in the white space in the bottom half of that form. Actually, I'm going to go over there so I can read it to you what it says. It says, I declare under penalty of perjury of the following, all of the following. Number one, I am a citizen or non-citizen national of the United States and have not performed any of the acts listed under acts and conditions on page 4 of the instructions of this application. So, I am a citizen or non-citizen national. Okay, so let me go back. So there's definitely, according to these endorsement codes, a huge difference between United States national and not a United States citizen. The FAM manual stands for Foreign Affairs Manual. Well, if we're not a citizen, then we're foreign to the United States. If we're not a U.S. citizen, we're foreign to the United States. Simple as that. This Foreign Affairs Manual that you can find on the Secretary of State's website, after searching, it took me about 2 hours, and I'm a pretty smart guy. And I didn't really know what I was looking for, but I found it. They also have another manual called the Foreign Affairs Handbook. But what I really noticed about this handbook and this manual is that none of the links work. When you click on one of the links in this manual, it takes you to, and I'm using Chrome to do this, but it takes you to another page that says blocked in the address. They blocked half of this code. So what I did, and for the people that are on that have already seen my paperwork, what I did was I went through the whole Foreign Affairs Manual, and I listed each blocked or unavailable code that they have in that manual, and it came down to 208 of them. I'm not talking about the links to go to the specific sections. I'm talking about whole titles. I'm talking about whole sections. 208 titles. So how can we use that to our advantage? This is what I thought up all by myself. I can't tell you it's going to work yet, but I can tell you I'm in the pipeline now, and I did go to a post office. I did not go to the Bureau of Consular Affairs, create a ticket to the Netherlands, and tell them that I was leaving in 4 days, so I needed it right away, and I did add an explanatory statement to it and also a memorandum of law showing without fail that there are two classes of citizens in the United States. Actually, for those of you that heard me talk about getting my replacement Social Security card several months back, it's pretty much the same two-page letter that I gave to them that took me 3.5 hours, it took them 3.5 hours to figure out. I was born in Georgia, but I was not a U.S. citizen. And you know what? A couple of days ago at the post office, I didn't have much luck there either because I asked the lady, I said, how long have you been processing passports for the post office? And she said 16 years. But she could not wrap her head around the fact that I claimed that I was not a U.S. citizen, even though she knew I was born in the state of Georgia, or at least she assumed that I was born in the state of Georgia. When I said Georgia Republic or Georgia State, she had no clue what I was talking about. 16 years, folks. If it wasn't for people like us, everybody would, you know, God says in the end times that he'll let people believe the lies. But it's been forced on us. So anyway, what I did, my miraculous idea, okay, and we can expand on this later on, but my idea was, why not write a conditional acceptance letter to the Bureau of Consular Affairs at the Secretary of State and tell them that what we're going to do is I'm going to fill my passport out and make the application and pay for it and send it in, but I don't know the endorsement codes because they're hidden or blocked on your website. So if I fill it out incorrectly, then you stipulate that you will change those codes for me if I happen to get back a passport that does not reflect my true status and standing in the United States of America. It's got to work. It must work. Otherwise, they're going to get a follow-up letter from me saying, the last time I saw the State Department of a state or a country hiding the actual codes from their people was Hitler's Germany. 208 sections, some of them the entire title, blocked. The sections I can see say unclassified at the top and the bottom of the page, but this is the State
Department,
folks.
How long it'll take him to wake up? How long do you think it'll take for him to wake up?
Who, the passport agent?
You're dealing with the same regime that came into this country under Operation Paperclip.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how long it'll take them to wake up. I know it took the Social Security Administration.
I'm talking about you, brother. I'm talking about you, brother. You're dealing with criminals.
Well,
you're going to
ask
the criminals to give you some relief.
No, I'm not asking them. I'm conditionally accepting their offer to pay for the passport. And if they don't give me a passport that gives me 5 stars on it, then now I've got remedy. Now I've got relief. It's their endorsement codes, not mine.
You know how many people are rotting in filthy jail?
Well, if that's the price I got to pay, partner, to get a free America, I'm willing to pay it.
Ted?
That's pretty honorable.
Give me liberty or give me death, man. I love that guy. Go ahead.
And what people should read, which I'm sure you have, is Give Me Liberty and Give Me Death. The most profound statement in that address that he gave is in the first paragraph. The first paragraph.
You got it in front of you?
Not at the moment. The first paragraph.
Okay, go ahead.
I found. So I'll pull it up. But what I wanted to ask, this is Nastasha, by the way. It's nice to hear you. I've been on your calls with Guy. So two questions. One is, have you already given this meeting information on regards to 3 stars versus 5 stars? And then on my passport card, I do have the number 09, but I'm not sure if that number, where it's located, is applicable, because I had sent in an affidavit with my passport renewal. And I know somebody who, in that part that you read, they crossed off U.S. citizen and left national. And they returned the form and told them that they needed to resubmit it because it was defaced.
Right, which they'll do. But that endorsement code, there's nothing around it that says that I can't fill it out myself.
That you can't do it, right. So do you have any information yet on the meaning of the stars? And then
yes, I do. I've got it right up in front of me.
Oh, okay. Because that seems to be the big question among everybody, and nobody that I'm surrounded with has that info.
Okay.
And then I do have, which I don't know if this is applicable, but I do have an 09 on my passport card below my picture.
Well, then you're not a U.S. citizen, sister. Congratulations.
Yeah. So yeah, it worked. Thank you.
How many
and
stars
on the
did you get?
And on the back of my card, in brackets with IPUSAC 281350490, it has, you know, the two brackets. It says 09, bracket 45, bracket, and then another whole long list of numbers. So,
okay,
what did
you
just
bracket
ask
45
me?
And bracket 9?
Before the 45, there's a bracket dash 09, not dash.
Yes.
There's two, you know, brackets that face to the left. 09,
yes.
And then one bracket that faces to the right that says 45. And then there's, you know, a whole series, 3 lines of letters and numbers with
okay.
my name.
So let me tell you what they are. I'll tell you 45. I told you 9.
Right.
You're a United
so
States
I have that.
National, not yes. a U.S. citizen. 45 means this. This passport expires on month, day, year, and was issued by the Department of State under 22 CFR 51.2B in parentheses. B is in Baker. 22 CFR 51.2B, and here's the notes on that code. And also, I want to tell you there's an informational notice that the State Department put out called IN-941-03. IN-941-03. And then it also says C8FAM1004.1 and 8FAM504.1. So that's 8FAM1004.1 and 8FAM504.1. This is what it says.
504.1.
504.1.
Yes. Okay. 504.1. Yeah, I got that. Thank you.
This is what it says. Use when the first passport is unavailable due to visa processing delay or when a foreign country will deny a visa or entry to the bearer of a passport containing markings or visas showing travel to certain other countries. Second passport books cannot be extended. Limited regular passport books to 4 years. Limit diplomatic, official, or no-fee regular passport books to 1 year less than the expiration date of the current passport book, not to exceed 4 years. So this is what I want to tell you. They do this to everybody. They give you 1 year to see what you're going to do. And if you're clean that entire year, the next passport you get will have 5 stars on it. How many stars does your ID card
get? What do you mean clean?
In other words, they see you as no. Let me explain the 5 stars, what they mean, and then you'll understand what I mean by clean.
Yeah, okay? And to answer your question, I got 3 stars.
Okay, you got 3 stars. So.
Yeah.
So that's the general what they do, and you are a perfect situation as to why I put the conditional acceptance into them first. They have an officer there called the Legal Affairs and Law Enforcement Officer. And while I didn't specifically send my business letter to them first, to them in general, I sent it to the Bureau of Consular Affairs, because if they don't answer it, the other side of my conditional acceptance of the letter, which they must answer if they're hiding the codes from us, right? That makes sense, right?
Yeah.
If they don't answer it within 14 days, then they stipulate that they agree that I'm not a U.S. citizen. And also, I'm going to tell you what I wrote in my conditional acceptance, because the word sovereign is in there. But let me tell you what the stars mean. The stars on the passport card represent 5 types, or if you will, 5 levels of citizenship. 1 and 2 stars means nothing, and you better obey the system as a U.S. citizen slave. 3 stars is something called Capitus Maximus, or citizen slave, which makes you a national but still a threat.
Capitus.
4 stars is Maximus.
Okay.
It means citizen slave.
But I'm still a national.
You're still a national, right? The statutory rules and promulgated regulations do not apply to you. But you'll probably still get a ticket if they pull you over. Like I said, they're going to give you a year. Is yours a 4-year passport or a 10-year passport?
I renewed mine, so I believe it's a 10-year passport. My passport doesn't have these numbers on it, so I'm trying to figure out the difference between how they identify their information between the two. But the passport card is the one that I've been sharing with you, and this one expires, 10 years, 2032.
Okay, did you mark that you were not a U.S. citizen on your passport application? Everyone?
It was on my – I didn't need to, because it was a renewal form. I attached an affidavit to it. I attached an affidavit that clearly stated what I'm not and what I am.
Okay, good. Good.
Yeah.
So 3 stars is Capitus Maximus. It means citizen slave, which makes you a national but still a threat. So in the eyes of the law, you are not a U.S. citizen. You're a national. 4 stars is Capitus Medius, which achieves do not detain status regarding statutory regulations, but not corpus delicti crimes, which, for those that you don't know, means is there an injured party? If you injure someone out there, it doesn't matter how many stars you got on your passport.
Right.
Five stars is Capitus Minimus, which gives you diplomatic immunity and allows you to walk past TSA and other government agencies as being no threat to them at all. And there's the meaning of your one to five star passports. So obviously we all want diplomatic immunity, right?
Yeah. So what I find interesting, based on your information, which I know you, and I know you're very thorough and very credible, and I respect your information, is that there are some people who seem to be automatically getting the diplomatic immunity, but I could still be treated as a citizen, but I still have that national status. So I may not get to go through TSA, but that doesn't mean I'm not a national in their book.
That's correct. That's correct, because '09 specifically states, I'll read it again,
right,
because this bears, nobody is telling us about these endorsement codes.
And I know.
The way they design the form, they don't show you that you can mark them. But it says the bearer is a United States national and not a United States citizen. It's as plain as day. That's what that code means.
Now, it makes sense to me.
Go ahead. I was just going to say,
it makes perfect sense to me.
It makes perfect sense to me because 8 U.S.C. 1452b1 says if you read the notes to that title or to that specific statute, it says in 1992 that they changed it over, and instead of making a special passport for state citizens, they just did it through the passport itself. That's when they changed it in 1992. This endorsement code that I'm looking at says prior to the creation of this endorsement code in 1992. This is what they changed. So right there where it says END period with the number sign and the line to the right, anybody that does a passport from here on out, 09. Put the 09 in there.
Can I just state, and I'll yield after this.
Exactly on the form that you're talking about. I have my form opened up. I got my passport in front of me. My passport card is brand new. Just had it issued 2 months ago. Can you point? I don't see where you're talking on this form where you can put in.
Okay. Yes, John. I will answer that in just a second. I just want to finish up with her. Go ahead and ask your questions.
Okay. Now, this is what's interesting to me is that when I go over to my passport book, which I ordered both at the same time with the affidavit, I do not see it. All the numbering is completely different. There's no similar numbers, which I understand that's how they do it. There is no 09. There is no 09. And I don't see there's not any stars or anything.
Okay, but at the back you see the barcode, right?
Yeah, and that's 671-687-637.
They scan
with
that.
The barcode, right?
Yeah, they scan that, and that's where the endorsement codes come up when they scan that barcode.
Okay.
Now, go back over to your card, though. I'm going to show you something interesting here. On the front of your card, does it say U.S. National or USA?
Nationality, USA.
Okay. So U.S. National will be printed instead of USA on the front of the passport card. So look at your book again. And see if you see the word U.S. National.
It says nationality on my card, and it has USA.
Okay. What about the book?
And then, okay, where do you want me to go to the book?
Just the front. It's going to say, it's United States of America or U.S. National.
It says United States of America, the same as my last passport.
Okay. So what it could be is that code 45. You remember when I told you the thing about they hold off a year just to see what you're going to do with your diplomatic status? And if everything's hunky-dory and kosher within that year, most likely you're going to end up with the diplomatic immunity.
How would I know?
May I ask you?
How would I know?
You'll know the next the next time you get, well, you can call the Bureau of Consular Affairs now that you know they're hiding the codes from you.
Okay.
You can call them and ask them. Say, hey, I tried to do my due diligence, but if you're blocking codes and blocking the links to the endorsement code that I need, how am I supposed to fill out my application correctly? Right?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Go ahead. Was that you, John?
But you had one other question. I'm sorry. You were going to ask me one other thing. If you don't remember, that's okay.
No. I'm telling you that
they are
at the State Department. They're hiding the code, the endorsement codes. And the way they did it on the application, which I'm about to answer John's question next.
Okay.
They don't have any white space there. They just have the dark space. So it doesn't look, when you look at it, this is why I call it the needle in the haystack. When you look at it, it makes you think that you don't put anything there, that that's their job or something, but there's nothing around it saying not to mark on here, on this section.
Right.
That's what they did.
Right.
I mean, these people are shysters, and the guy earlier that saying you're dealing with a bunch of crooks, he's right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
I can't
absolutely.
Argue that. Can't argue that. Go ahead, John.
Thank you, and I
yield.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Okay, Ed. I just got a brand new passport about 8 weeks ago. I have it in front of me with my passport card, and I have the DS-11 form opened up on my computer. I'm looking for the one that I executed because I always keep a copy of the one that I executed just for in case we get into what we're getting into right now.
Right. Up at the top, the expiration date, does it say 4/30/2025? 04/30/2025.
Okay.
It'll be page 4.
So are you talking about the part where I complete out, where you start to complete? Page 4/4 is all instructions.
Yeah, at the very top right.
Of page 4?
Page 4, yeah, where it says application for U.S. passport.
Ed, isn't that the one with the picture on it? Are you talking about that page?
I'm sorry. You're right. It's page 5. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay, that's what I was saying. That's where you lost me a long time ago. Okay.
Sorry, buddy.
So it's page 5. Okay, now we're apples to apples. Go ahead.
Oh, and by the way, this is a good point to bring up right here. All that junk that they talk about, mark this out and that out under the acts and terms and conditions on the first 4 pages, forget all that bunk because they throw those pages away. I sat there and watched this processing agent take the first 4 pages off, keep the last 2 pages, and she chunked the rest of it in the trash. So forget all that. That means nothing. All right, go ahead, John. You still there, John?
Yep, I'm here. So, top right-hand corner, you got a D, an O, an S.
No, above that, at the very top, expiration date. It says OMB control number 1405-0004.
Go ahead, Ed.
Yeah, I'm saying it says at the very top right of the 5th page, it says OMB control number 1405-0004 in small writing.
Correct.
Underneath it, it has the expiration date. What is the expiration date?
12/31/2023.
Okay. So I filled out the new one. All right. So underneath the label on the top right, does it have the letters D, O, S, and then NFR?
Correct.
Okay, underneath that, you see where it says END period with the number sign in the line?
Yep.
That's where the endorsement code goes, right there.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying you say we can put that endorsement code in there?
Yes, sir. It doesn't say that I can't.
Oh, shit.
It doesn't say right above this line only. I'll tell you how to handle this problem, John, because I like you. You're the only judge that I ever liked.
Thanks, buddy. It means a lot coming from you.
I know. Go on their website and find the DS-5504 form.
Okay.
All right. What that form, when you look that form up, 5504, what you're going to find out is that if you got back a passport with incorrect information on it, that that you have up to a year to change it at no charge. And then I'll have to get with you later about what to write them to make sure you get the 5 stars. How many stars did they give you?
My passport book, not card, well, I'm sorry, my card, says has 3 stars underneath the word passport.
And you were a judge?
Yeah, they screwed me, didn't they?
Yes, they did. That's okay, buddy. I got an answer for them.
Good.
All right, let me just read this because I'm getting long in the tooth here. Let me read this to you guys, what I wrote in my conditional acceptance letter. And don't worry, John, I got a way around this. Even though you didn't file this, I got a way around it. Let's just talk tomorrow. You know, just give me a call tomorrow.
You got it.
In the afternoon
yep.
Somewhere, okay?
You got
it. I am requesting that you please provide me with a certified copy of these missing instructions. Now, I've already got all the codes listed above this, so I'm going down into this business letter, which, by the way, is 11 pages. If you ask me why it's 11 pages, it's because I don't want them to answer it. Simple as that. I do not want them to answer it. I don't want them to give me every missing code under FOIA and the Privacy Act. I don't want that. I don't want them to even answer it. I am requesting that you please provide me with a certified copy of these missing instructions noted above so that I may ensure that I will fill out the DS-11 application properly and that the propriety of these acts will be such that I should receive the correct passport with 5 stars on its face that reflects my true status and standing on the continent of America as a just sanguineous American state national, with my allegiance solely to the state that God Almighty himself had chosen for me, born on the land of the Republic of Georgia State as both a sovereign and an indentured servant to him who created me as his personal ambassador and diplomat, to serve him and no other, and as a true beneficiary of the public trust, so that no federal or state government officer, employee, or agent may ever again mistake me for a person as defined by law or state statutes ever again, including but not limited to federal statutes, or as a decedent while still alive, or as a U.S. citizen, or any other legal entity created by government or its agencies henceforth. I am a man, a true Georgian by right of blood, born in the Republic and on the land known as the continent of the United States of America. Without the United States or any other corporation, and not a federal or state employee or agent registered or otherwise, and not a state agency, nor employed by any state or state agency, nor am I a lifetime surety, debtor, or warranted contracting officer of any sort, type, kind, or likeness. I am simply an honest man with clean hands and always standing in and with honor, never a threat to anyone inside my guaranteed Republican form of government, nor outside of it. My national passport that I am applying for with the required process in the DS-11 application should reflect all of the above to all of government, both foreign and domestic, within the boundaries of the United States and the United States with the lowercase u. I will attach an explanatory statement to my DS-11 application to reflect all of those facts stated above. For proper processing of my DS-11 passport application with the correct endorsement codes properly applied, I need the answers to all my requests in this business letter. And then I'm just going to cut to the chase and go down to where I put the conditional acceptance in. This is what I said. The Georgia Open Records Act and FOIA laws require response time within 3 business days. I do realize that it could take the federal state department or departments up to 14 days to respond. If access to these records I am requesting from you will take longer than 14 days, please contact me with information about when I might be able to expect the copies or have the ability to inspect the requested records. If I do not receive an answer that includes the records and information that I've requested in a timely manner, then it will be a stipulation by the department that all correspondence contained in this business letter should have been answered and could be deemed or construed as silence is acquiescence according to our own laws. Respectfully submitted. That's it. Then I did a memorandum of law, you know, where I had two pages of how there's two classes of citizens and we're all being pigeonholed into one. And, you know, and I did an explanatory statement. And actually, I got my explanatory statement from a dear friend of mine that actually got a 5-star passport, but even she had to write back in to get it. So I'm currently testing the process. I'm not going to release any of this until I get it done. I've got 5 good people all over the country doing the same process that I'm doing right now, and we will come back and report to you what happened. So does anybody have any other questions about the U.S. passport and getting the 5 stars out of the gate?
No question, but I just make a comment. It's funny that we're having this because I didn't realize that this was the topic tonight. But yesterday I spent about 3-4 hours, almost 4 hours with a guy driving around, going to the sheriff's, going to the police, going to the county clerks, because I wanted verification of my American state citizenship status on my passport, and nobody could get it. And so this guy that I was driving with told me he could get it, and I said, I don't think so. Let's go. I'll go with you. And when he told me he got it at the county clerk's office, I went with him back to the county clerk's yesterday, and no such thing. So I don't know if he was dreaming at the time or what, but I can guarantee he didn't get it. And so I was having a friend of mine tomorrow morning who's a clerk for a judge, going to try to pull mine up on Nexus to see what he could pull up. But what you're telling me now is even if he can pull me up on Nexus, he's not going to be able to find it because I only got 3 stars.
Actually, I got some information for everybody in the group too, because I talked to a real smart guy in Ohio this past week. So I'm going to, everybody get a pen and a piece of paper. I'm going to give you a phone number. Yes.
It's Jackie. I have a really quick question, a yes or no question. A rudimentary question. We're going to fill out the passport info for my daughter this evening, but she doesn't have any of the national paperwork done. Can we still file as a national without having any of the other paperwork filed?
Absolutely. You'd be lying to the State Department if you claimed that your daughter was a U.S. citizen.
Okay.
You have to answer
right.
No.
Thank
and that includes
you.
The
Thank
parents. That includes the parents, too, by the way, Jackie. Y'all aren't U.S. citizens either. Okay.
Beautiful, yeah. Thank you so much.
Sure. Everybody get a pen and a passport, a pen and a piece of paper and a 5-star passport. And I'm going to give you a number here in a second that you can all call. You're going to ask for a level 3 report from LexisNexis. Turns out they have 2 sides to their business. Let me go back. I want to just finish on the passport. So in my business process letter, I put copies off of their website of these endorsement codes, the ones that are pertinent to what I'm trying to accomplish. And I tell them, is there any reason that I cannot have the 09 endorsement code that I have put on my DS-11 application? And I don't expect them to answer any of us. I do not expect them to answer the letter, and I expect us all to get 3- or 4-star passports. So I'll be working on the second letter, the follow-up letter after, but they're in a hole. And for those of you that don't know Chris Hauser, this is how he got a hold of the IRS. He sent them a conditional acceptance letter and said, hey, I'm going to start filling out these 1099s unless you give me the specific instructions on how to do this. And if you don't, then I can't be held liable for any damage that I cause. Well, after about, 100 or so 1099s that he filled out incorrectly, they called him up and said they were going to prosecute him. And he said, you can't. We're in contract with each other. He told him he sent him a copy of his conditional acceptance, and a week later they called him and told him exactly how to fill out the 1099s and sent him 1,000 of them. So, you know, there's something to be said for this, but finding this foreign affairs manual, you know, and here's something else I want to tell the group. every time I find the relief for an American state national or a state citizen, you know, Daniel and David will both tell you that in all of my documents when I started, I put state citizen. I was a state citizen with a capital S and a capital C. But then I found out what the word citizen actually means. So, you know, I'm good with American state national or state national. My allegiance is to the state, as long as they understand that. And believe me, with my business process letter and my explanatory statement, they clearly will understand that my allegiance is to the state and not to the United States. So with that said, that's about all I got on the passport. So stay tuned. Y'all come back and we'll tell you what if we get answered on our business letters. And also, I should tell the group this. Why did I call it? Some of you might be wondering, why did I call it a business process letter? And if you're saying that to yourselves, that's a great question. I found this law. I got it under Georgia. I found this law right here. This is what the law says. It's OCGA 24-14-23. It's in the evidence code under Title 24 of the Georgia Code, Chapter 14, Proof Generally, Article 2, Presumptions and Estoppel, Section 24-14-23, Presumptions from Failure to Answer Business Letter. This is the name of this law, and this is what it says. In the ordinary course of business, when good faith requires an answer, it is the duty of the party receiving a letter from another to answer within a reasonable time. Otherwise, the party shall be presumed to admit the propriety of the acts mentioned in the letter of the party's correspondent and to adopt them. That's a huge four last words, folks, and to adopt them. Some of you might have noticed when I read that where I said, to admit to the propriety of the acts mentioned. I actually wrote that in my letter. I got that.
It's also in the Palliford case. In the Palliford case.
Okay.
It says that silence is consent.
Yes. Yeah, and I got several laws about silence is acquiescence and silence is a condition of fraud. And I got several cases.
Well, that'd be beneficial to you because you're in Georgia and that's a Georgia case.
That's correct, and that's why I called it a business letter. If you're in California or Ohio or West Virginia, you may not want to call it a business letter. You may want to call it a FOIA request.
Now, I tell you what, guys, this is a real meaty call, and we're approaching now over 3 hours and 5 minutes. And so what I'm going to ask that we do is we can try to wrap this thing up for the people that have to hear this call. But keep in mind that the subject matter from now can splinter off into a lot of different directions. And we just finished up the passport information that Ed gave us an earful. I have a question, and I haven't been able to speak in edgewise. And Darren is, by the way, I'm going to let the people know that myself and Darren are scheduled to do a call, maybe with Harold, on the very specific subject of the citizenship information.
You're breaking up a little bit.
Okay. My bad. I think I got a storm coming in. Darren and myself will be doing, we've got a call scheduled very specifically about the terms and the words of art and the United States citizen and national and the such like that we can all listen to. And that is scheduled, and it should be on happening in the next few weeks, I hope, Darren, and maybe even Harold will still be able to join that call. Ed, I've got a question that is just bugging me. Where did you find the information? It's not like you were reading it from a publication that explained these different stars. What site or authority were you relying upon to say this star, these many stars mean this? What was that from?
I found it in a Latin book, a book in Latin. But what I was doing was I was researching that book that I sent you guys earlier, that 26-page book where I read you O'Donohue versus United States from, legal basis for the term non-resident alien. And I found it in a site, and it turns out that they've had five-star passports for ever since they really started the program. They've always had endorsement codes. It's just nobody ever talks about them. And
very, very phenomenal.
They hit it.
Mind-blowing.
They hit it. Yeah, they hit it by calling it the Foreign Affairs Manual. So you think about it. I make this argument in my U.S. citizenship argument. If a judge asks you, are you some kind of alien or are you a U.S. citizen, how many of you, before you listen to me or what these other guys said, would say that you're an alien? Probably none of you. You probably don't. No, I'm a U.S. citizen. They did it on purpose. If you're going to call me anything, don't call me an American state national. Don't call me a state citizen. Call me a non-resident alien, because now I know what it means. Non-resident to any of your to your jurisdiction, your corporate jurisdiction, and alien to all your foreign treaties, statutes, and laws. That's what non-resident alien means. So, yeah, if you're going to call me anything, call me a non-resident alien. I'm good with that. If they call me a United States national, though, I can tell you this from at least the standpoint of the State Department of the United States Corporation, that I'm not a U.S. citizen if they call me a U.S. national. It's one or the other. There's only two choices on that DS-11. Are you a United States citizen? Yes or no. There's no other choice. So, anyway, that's what I had to say on that subject. I mean, and listen, it's nobody's fault. I mean, they've convoluted the law so badly that we can't even call it law anymore. They've actually got private international treaty law in our own state statutes in every state, and I can prove it. I mean, it shouldn't be this way. But, you know, the longer we talk, the smarter we get, and the more we study, the more we figure out. But I wanted to design a process, and I'm testing it out right now, where I've never owned a passport, folks. Never owned a passport of any kind. So I'm testing it out now to see, after the paperwork that I put in, how many stars comes back on that ID card. And, you know, I'll take pictures of it and share it with the group and tell you if they answered my business letter or not. But this ought to be interesting. And if nothing else, I mean, I don't think there's anybody out there that could call me dull. I mean, I'm always looking at stuff like this. But if I get a five-star passport, that means I've got diplomatic immunity. And you can get away with murder with diplomatic immunity in this nation. Not that I want to do that. I just want to be left alone, kind of like you fine folks. I just want to be left alone. I want to worship my God and be left alone.
Ed, I just want to tell you that I'm a listening man. I have a set of glasses on, and I'm looking at the Code of Federal Regulations that John spoke at the beginning of the call in 1.1441-1C3, where he read in his letter describing an alien individual. Can you hear me?
Yes.
And I'm finding that there's this little bit of a controversy there, and at some point in time, I'd like to be able to address that when we have another 3 hours to spend. So, and we're going to have another.
I can wrap it up in 5 seconds. I can wrap that up for you in 5 seconds.
Go ahead. If you.
Yeah, I know the answer to this. Title 26 came after 1933, not prior. And if you read the INA laws of 1802, specifically 2 Stat 153, Section 28, Clause 1, an alien may become a citizen, a U.S. citizen, a citizen of the United States in the following manner, and not otherwise.
No otherwise. 2 Stat 153.
Yeah, 2 Stat 153, Clause 28, Section 1. And I sent you that earlier. I sent you my revamped argument about that in the email. But look, here's what I want to say. They're slowly, you know, when I sent in my U.S., my assertory oath and declaration that I was not a U.S. citizen to the Secretary of State, I used the frog in the boiling water concept as I went through that document and told them why, even if they did deem me as a U.S. citizen, that I refused to be. And basically, anybody that knows this theory knows that if you if you throw a frog into a boiling pot of water, he's going to jump right out. But if you've got the water cool and you turn it up a little bit at a time, he will boil inside that pot before he jumps out. And that's what's happening to us. They do it.
There's a reason why they do that. They do that because of 22 USC 212. They need your allegiance, which creates the reciprocal obligation, allegiance for protection. And what if you say, I don't owe you any allegiance? Now they're, what are they going to do?
Right, which brings to my mind Hale versus Hinkle. I owe the state no duty.
Right, even though it says it does call him a citizen, which is a little bit different than what a national is, because even in the preliminary term, citizen, say Black Law 6, is one who submits himself to the dominion of government, which is also cited in the Kershank case as well, uses the same terminology. It goes to that form of government. Now, here's the difference, though. When you call yourself a state national, which I don't like the term American state national because that's not in the federal statutes at large, where a state national is under volume 66-101A21, and that is one who owes an allegiance to a state, which is small s. Now, if you go into the Afram v. Russ case, 1967, it defines that the term state means the people and not the Congress. In other words, not to the government, which goes back to what Jesus said when the attorney asked him, what's the greatest commandment? Love God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and love your neighbor like yourself. This will be followed by all the law and all the prophets. He was referring to your neighbor. That's what the state is your neighbor. That's the closest thing that you got from a biblical standpoint.
Okay, I agree with everything that you said, but here's the problem. Okay, here's the rub. According to their own endorsement codes at the State Department, I can either be a United States national or a United States citizen. One or the other. There's no third option. So I would rather be, if, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, I'd rather be a United States national because that means I'm not a U.S. citizen. And if I'm not a U.S. citizen, their statutes don't apply to me.
Now, does that mean, does that apply while you're here domestically or does it apply when you're abroad?
Well, think about it. What's the passport designed for? Travel.
Well, that's the point. In other words, because the law is based on presumptions, that's also a presumption. And in other words, how they're using it, where it could still be a matter of, I need a more definite statement from your department. You know what I'm saying?
I'm going to get it. I'm going to get that definite statement.
And there's something, and I have this document. I could send it to you. I could send it to Zero. But it's actually under the, let me see if I pronounce it correctly, the International Aviation, Civil Aviation Documents, which is the Readable Travel Documents, number 12, 5th edition. And it's talking about nationality, especially to a state as an undefined nationality, which is code XXX, and it says that the person, even though they have an undefined nationality, is neither stateless nor a refugee. It's just that his nationality is undefined because when your nationality is to a state and not to the United States, because when you're abroad, there's no refugee that the states have employed through foreign countries. It's only the United States that have embassies there. So that's why it's considered undefined, because all passports have the INS code, in which United States is the only, like the states don't have their own INS code, only the United States has it.
Hey, listen, the way things are going now, I don't know how secure that U.S. passport is going to be or how much longer it's going to be secure, to be honest with you. But I do know that it guarantees me safe passage. It guarantees me in the United States.
Well, listen, I tell you what, they keep pushing Putin the way he is. he might not have the United States to be talking about.
I know.
Ed,
All right, guys, going to wrap this call up tonight. And
One more thing. I want to tell John. I want to give everybody that 888 number so they can get their level 3 report. But I want to tell John, if I was him tomorrow when I got up, I'd go to the airport and have one of the TSA agents run it because that's what they do for a living and ask them.
I did it.
I did it.
I just did it 2 weeks ago. I had a flight to Florida for the weekend. Florida through the weekend. I brought my passport. I gave him the passport, and I stood right in front of the computer screen as he ran it. Nothing came up that would help me in any way, shape, or form. That's why I
don't worry, buddy. I'm gonna straighten you out.
Yeah.
I'm gonna straighten you out.
Straighten me out. All right. Okay.
I have a phone question number, though.
Okay.
One of my questions.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
You know, one of my questions is it appears that the entity that we're talking, the man that has the status that is without the United States, okay, and that is of a republic, a state of a republic, a state, that man cannot be referenced in statutes, and they don't, I'm going to present it, possibly they don't reference it ever in a statute because they don't have authority to reference it. That's why they don't reference it. And I'm just curious, you're saying for purposes of the passport for travel that, oh, well, now you're saying that they are able to reference it for
yes,
that
they
purpose.
Are.
So
they
I'm
are
curious.
Because of eight, because of 2 Stat 153, Clause 28, Section 1. We're called aliens. We were called non-resident aliens back in 1802 because we weren't part of the corporations. And you can go back and look at the Federalist Papers, numbers 42 and 43 by James Madison of 1787. January of 1788, the year after the Constitution came out. He says specifically in those papers that the government was deathly afraid of the aliens shutting them down from forming the corporations. Now, back then, it was just the 13 colonies. So who were the aliens they were referring to? They weren't referring to the Indians. They were talking about the people of the colonies. They were aliens to the corporations. So we became non-resident aliens. And it was the same way in 1864 when William Whiting made his speech, who was then the Attorney General of the United States. And it was the same way in 1893 when Rehm versus City of Minneapolis case evolved, and they told you specifically what you had to do to become a U.S. citizen.
See, yeah, but in Chisholm v. Georgia, the people were sovereign. They said that in Chisholm v. Georgia. That was, 1793?
Right.
1794?
They started forming the corporations. When they started forming these corporations, they started changing the law slowly. And it's almost like they're trying to eradicate the non-resident aliens. Matter of fact, the only place I can find the term is in the statute that John quoted. Now, if the original 13 colony citizens were called non-resident aliens, then how is it that it ends up in Title 26 after 1933? They wanted to tax everybody. That's how it ended up there.
Well, they did that when they instituted
that phone number, Ed. Ed, you going to give us that phone number?
Oh yeah.
And then we're going to wrap it up, guys.
All right, it's 888-497-0011. You will have.
And I know that everybody's
security number.
Hey, Ed. I think you did a phenomenal job tonight, as usual, in giving us a lot to think about, and I greatly appreciate our fellowship. We've been at this fellowship for over a year or two, I'm imagining, and I have a great respect for you and what you have to share tonight. Brother, I appreciate you.
Sure. I'm just trying to help you guys.
You're phenomenal, and I appreciate everybody showing up the House of Prayer call. I know that we can probably go to 2 in the morning, but I cannot do it. I have actually some chores I got responsible for tonight, and I love you all tremendously and expect to hear back here on the 12th of May. Yeah, where the call will be resumed with Dave Edwards. In the meanwhile, can you all look to the myhouseshallbecalled.com for this recording and the information that Ed presented to me by email to share with you, as well as John tonight on myhouseshallbecalled.com. And the call will resume on the 12th, like I said, of May, but there will be the very hopeful chance that Darren and I will be able to make that recording on that very detailed subject that we can all be in community with as we consider the things that he has to share as far as his study is concerned. Everybody on this call was phenomenal. I didn't hear much from Dave tonight. We talk every day, and make sure you go to Dave's call this Sunday night when he has How to Win in Court Without a Liar. And Ed, it's always a pleasure to have you here. I'm going to wrap this call up tonight, just under the 3.5-hour call, and I love you all. See you then. See you next time.